Thank you, Brittany, for handling this again, as usual. Okay. Welcome to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District No. 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, March 23, 2022. This virtual meeting is being held under Governor Inslee's COVID-19 Notice of Proclamation 2028, and there is no live public comment period. However, our community members are welcome to comment on any item or concern via a letter addressed to the commissioners at 834 Sheridan Street, Port Townsend, 98368, or via email to commissioners@jeffersonhealthcare.org. You may join us live on our Microsoft Teams meeting through our website at www.jeffersonhealthcare.org. Select About Us, then Hospital Commission, and scroll down to the links. You may also join audio only at 509-598-2842 and enter ID number 383-682-973 hashtag. This session is being officially audio recorded and time shown on the agenda are estimate only. All commissioners are present, as is our CEO, Mike Glenn. I now call for a move to approve today's agenda.
So moved.
Second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded. Is there discussion? All in favor, please hold up your hand. Okay, that looks unanimous. Thank you. And then we will now go right into our first part of our meeting, which would be the education topics. And the first part of that is our governance discussion. So I'll open it now to comments on our March 16th generative governance retreat. So, Case, I saw that you wrote a letter to Karma saying, expressing your thoughts about the retreat. Would you like to share them with us?
Sure. I believe I sent it to all of the commissioners. At least I hope I did.
You did? Yeah.
Yeah, it was that I thought it was an outstanding retreat. And when I look at the requirements for what makes generative thinking work, I think we really met those. Perhaps the most important part of that is picking a topic for which there has been no plan as of yet generated by management, so that we can be in that really creative space of not being guided in our thinking and in our exploration by work that management has already done. And I thought actually the way we work together, the way we brainstormed was perhaps, in my opinion anyway, the best meeting we've ever had.
Great. What are other thoughts? What went well and what could we improve on for our next generative session, which it'll be the next quarter, in the next quarter? I think it's in mid-June. What do you think? What stood out? Anything that you surprised you about that process, or something that, did you have any aha moments? Was it worthwhile?
You're so good at prompting us with questions, Jill.
But nobody's answering.
I know. I don't know.
Come on, you guys.
I mean, I'll answer again, but let me wait.
I think it was worthwhile. I think in some ways in the past, we've done some things that were, you probably could call generative governance, but not in a formal way like we did during this session. So, I mean, we were certainly more formal about it and what we were doing rather than haphazard. One thing I do have a question about is, were there minutes from that meeting?
There will be minutes, yes.
Okay, they're just not ready to approve today.
Correct.
Okay.
Any other comments? Well, I'm going to say I thought the brainstorming was really a great experience, and I'm amazed at some of the things we came up with. But you know, some of them were pretty far out, but a lot of them were, and even those are, you know, were worth considering. There are no bad ideas when you are brainstorming, but I thought that was a very fun experience and exercise.
Yeah, I think the free flow of ideas and with those ideas coming out of different individuals prompted other people to think of different things in different ways. And so that was, I think, a very good aspect of this, of what we did. And it certainly was worthwhile. I agree with Bruce. It was certainly worthwhile because, you know, otherwise you get stuck in one lane and don't even think about looking or outside and for innovative and maybe ideas that come to nothing or pretty kind of out there, but from that might stimulate something else. So I agree. Pretty good.
Matt, do you have any comments?
I thought it was a good exercise. It was good, worthwhile doing.
Okay, great. Well then, yeah, Case.
Well, I'm hoping that sometime before the next session, we can actually take a bit of time to look at the brainstorm list that Whitney so carefully helped us put together. Did I say Whitney?
You meant Brittany.
I meant Brittany, of course. And also, I think that in preparation for our next session, we're going to need to think carefully about what the topic would be, because the more I read about it, if you take a topic for which we have already gone down the road a certain distance, it really constrains the opportunity to do what we did with this one, which is really think out of the box. And because once we're in the box going down the road in a boxcar, it's difficult to think of other options. And there are so many things that the staff is already doing in a regenerative way when they sit together and they brainstorm, whether it's housing or childcare or whatever, that I think we need to, perhaps we can ask Mike and the staff to help us really identify what aren't they working on yet? Where don't they already have too many ideas? And what would be an appropriate topic for us to tackle? So we're at the top of the regenerative curve as opposed to the bottom. And then the last thing I would say is that I think that experience, at least I personally feel more connected to the rest of you on the board through that process, because we had more interchange of ideas and discussion and lots of good humor, much more so than we have during a very formal meetings where we don't have that kind of, quote, luxury of time to actually joke a bit with each other and thereby get to know each other and build camaraderie.
Yeah, I agree with you. We do have a list that we voted on, and we could look over that list again and see where we are with different things, and that would be a good exercise. Right. Yeah, right. Maybe what we could do is take another look at that list, and Brittany could send it out to us. She was so good at hurrying and getting that on screen for us, and we could kind of prioritize each of us for the next session and think of anything else that we could think of that and send it to the, you know, to Brittany and for her to send out to the rest of the commissioners so we could prioritize.
Well, what would you think of asking Mike to take a look at that list? Absolutely. And to tell us which of those items would be most helpful for him? So which item on the list haven't they already brainstormed and worked to some conclusion on?
That's a great idea.
I took that as my takeaway. that, I was tasked with that. At the end of the meeting, it was sort of like, so what the hell do we do with all these great ideas? And we talked a little bit about the merging of generative thinking into operations and doing that elegantly. I think we agreed that I would sort of identify the ideas that either we were working on or that I thought fit best with some of our operational initiatives. So I'm happy to do that work, and we'll have that ready for our next generative governance.
So Mike, are you thinking of the list of things that we brainstormed with regards to funding, or are you thinking of the earlier list of topics that included things like housing and childcare and all that?
I was thinking the we agreed at the end of the last meeting that the ideas related to funding were to be reviewed by me and sort of prioritized. So that's the work I had in my mind.
And I certainly think that that would be wonderful. But I guess I'm wondering about that earlier list. Now that we've tackled at least part of the fundraising question, is there another topic that we need to be generative about? Or are we going to use generative thinking on one of the specific items in the list we came up with the last meeting? I guess that's the question that I have.
Well, that's what the board needs to discuss and decide. So the board thinks, if you have any comments about that along that line, if the board would please send them to Brittany, write them down, and email them to Brittany, and then we can go from there. That would be great.
Good.
Okay, it looks like we're almost ready to go to our next education topic, unless anyone has any other comments.
Would you all like me to send you the governance topics that you voted on once before out to the group?
That'd be great.
Yes, that'd be great.
I'll get that sent to you. My pleasure.
Thank you. Okay, then we will go ahead now into our education topic. And we have two important reports today. First, a population health update with Dunia Folks, our Executive Director of Population Health Analytics and Advocacy. And next, following that, will be Home Health and Hospice Quarterly Update by Executive Director Tammy Tarsa. So we'll start with Dunia, and welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us again. And with me is Dr. Molly Parker and Tina. So the three of us, some of the core members of the Population Health Group, and we're excited to talk to you about a few of things that we have going on. As you know, we're always working and shifting and identifying new priorities. And so there's a lot more than this, but these are the things we really wanted to update the board on. Next slide, please. And as part of our work, we always start now with our land acknowledgement. Which I think the board does as well, but I'll just leave this up here for just a moment before we move on to the actual presentation.
Question?
Yes, Case.
Do you want questions during the presentation, or would you prefer that you go all the way through and then we ask questions?
I think it's fun to pepper them in as we're going. That would be great. I'm going to try very hard, Tammy, to stay within our 30 minutes. We are going to give you your full 30 minutes, because I think the last time we presented was a year ago, and we went really wild there. So 30 minutes. So during would be awesome. Next slide, please. Did you have a question on this slide, though, Case?
I did. Did staff ever consider adding the word unseated, which is something that I've heard more and more about from different groups using land acknowledgements?
We have not, although I will point you to the parentheses next to our land acknowledgement at the top, which is this. That was the 2021 version. Tina and I have spent a lot of time talking about, do we reevaluate it? And so I think that that's a great conversation for us to have at the Health Equity Committee as we look more towards how to make it more relevant and make sure that it wasn't just something that we did, but we consistently revisit it as a team. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Next slide, thanks. So today we're going to talk a little bit about early life, about friends, food, and then we'll also talk briefly about equity as we sort of do a 2021 closeout. And I'm going to hand it over to Molly to talk about some of our early life work.
Next slide, please. Hi, everybody. Thanks for having us. So I'll start with early life. Dunya put underneath it lasts a lifetime. And I think part of that is because her daughter Cora's little life seems like it's lasting forever to her. But she's adorable. So we like that it's lasting a long time. Next slide, please. So just to remind you what early life is, the slides are in a little bit different order than I had. But I'll run through what early life is. It basically is the time from conception to 2 years of age. So it's about 1,000 days. And in that time period is some of the most important developmental time period in a person's life. And it can lay down the groundwork for their health for the rest of their lifetime, which is what we mean by early life. So we have a bunch of projects in that we're working on that occur in that time period of somebody's life. And the first one is upstream. Which you may have heard a little bit about. We've been talking to this nonprofit group called Upstream since about 2019. They work with health centers and health organizations to improve the contraception and family planning access that's available to our patients, partially by making things more efficient, but also by helping train providers and staff on an unbiased message, really trying to get the right contraception for the right person at the right time. And part of the reason behind that is that about 33% of the births in Washington are unplanned. It's much higher in other states. We actually do better than other places. About 41% of women had an unplanned pregnancy when they were using contraception. So what that tells us is that the contraception they were using wasn't quite right for them. It wasn't doing the job. And Upstream started its work back in 2014 in Delaware and have some great baseline data that show a reduction in unintended pregnancies in Delaware across the years that they worked there. They worked at health centers and hospitals all across the state and are using that data to drive their next methods. So we're in the early stages of working with them. It'll be a project through probably through the rest of this year. Right now, we're working on a needs assessment piece, and you may have heard or seen surveys go out after visits to providers at the clinic. So there's a text survey that is going out to all people who were sex female at birth, who were between the ages of 15 and 44 who had any visit in our primary care or women's clinic. So they'll be getting a text. And if you hear about it, be sure and let them know it's not spam and they will get $10 if they fill it out. We think. So, next slide, please.
Inflation seems to have paid, huh?
Yeah, people are interested. So another early life project is that you'll remember our fin bins that we were doing. We have graduated those to cribs for kids. So now our prenatal patients will get, if they want, it's basically a pack and play like what you see there with a bag of things that help in preparing for having a baby. So a book on what to expect, so safety kit, some diapers, etc. The Cribs for Kids is a national organization that provides Cribettes, which are the brand for the pack and plays, for a low cost. So we're able to purchase them at a really low cost and then hand them out, giving them along with a lot of information about safe sleep. So that's been going really well. You can see there was one behind me. It got used earlier this week. Next slide, please.
Can I ask a question, please?
Yeah.
So have there been any results for reducing sudden infant crib death? Any research? I'm sure there's research going on, but anything of any with having, you know, the baby boxes to start with, and then this cribs for kids. Are there any statistics yet?
It's a great question. So in our county, No, because SIDS is such a rare event that it's hard to say. Even if we had one and our rates went up, it would be difficult to say that that was because of a program or not because of a program. We do know that sleeping in on a surface that has nothing else on it with no other blankets or bumpers and sleeping on the back makes a huge difference. We also know that we have a high co-sleeping rate in our county. So it we really just extrapolate out and hope that this will make a difference.
Molly, do you want to talk a little bit about some of the other sort of outcomes that we're hoping for and looking at with this program, and then also some of the families that have maybe gotten it that didn't have other options for their kiddos?
Sure. Yeah. So it's been a moving project to do. Our nurses love to give these cribettes out because it starts a conversation about safe sleep, but it also starts a conversation about other needs in people's lives. And we've had many families or several families say to us that they didn't know where their baby was going to sleep before, that they were unhoused or couch surfing, and they were going to be having their new family living with another family and didn't have a place for their babies to sleep. This allowed some families, they tell us, to be able to buy food instead of buying a crib. So it's been a really moving thing for us to be able to actually give them something that's very usable. Junie, did you want to? Oh, go ahead. Mari, you said something.
Well, it just came to me, you know, the Echo, people have supplies of equipment that, you know, wheelchairs and commodes and those sorts of things. It's a pity we couldn't start like when people have finished with their baby equipment, that we couldn't start a sort of bank for loaning it out to new people, new mothers and families who don't have the ability. Just a thought came to me, like Echo, but for newborns or children, babies. High chairs, swings, all those good things.
Yeah, it's an interesting so firsthand experience as someone who recently had a kiddo almost 20 months ago now. As soon as everyone heard that I was pregnant, they descended on me with all of their baby swings and cribs and sleeping apparatus, because actually Goodwill does not take them because of the liability associated if something is recalled. And so people have nowhere to take these things. And so we need to think through sort of those processes. But there's definitely sort of an underground trade with new families to give these things out. I think at one point I had 6 swings in my garage. I'm down to only 2. So that's good. But it's definitely something that we've talked a little bit about, but would need to be really cognizant of sort of that liability piece. And it's great with the cribettes because they are so so high safe, so well maintained, and it's a national program that Molly has implemented here. Some of the other things that we are looking at as well is also just engagement with the healthcare system is one thing that we would like to see, that as soon as you get a mom on board, you get her family. She makes the healthcare decisions for her family. And so really engaging with her during this very vulnerable time of life is critical for that. Additionally, in addition to our prenatal patients, we also give them out on the floor if a mom hasn't even been here for prenatal care, because we want to make sure that every baby that we touch in this community has a safe place to sleep and their parents feel supported through us as their healthcare provider, even if it's only for that period of birth. We are still there. We're still there for them.
Thanks.
Yeah, so along those lines, we are working with First Steps of Clallam County and Jefferson County. They got a grant from the Commerce Department to create more diaper bank sites in Jefferson County, and they've asked if we would be a diaper bank site. If you haven't heard of that before, it's you know, really similar to our little free pantry or our food bags that we give out that you'll hear more about. So the hope is to have a closet, probably in Sheridan Clinic to start, where we will stock diapers that will be free for patients who need them, coming in all sizes. And with that, First Steps is able to do some care navigation as well. So if a family needs diapers, they probably need other things as well. So the First Steps navigators can give them a call and check and see if they need anything like food or help finding housing, et cetera. We'll also use our own care navigators for this too. And if we're able to take care of that capacity, we will do that internally, but First Steps is available as well. So we're excited about that. We expect that to start in the next few months.
Dr. Parker?
Yeah.
Welcome, and thanks for being with us. Regarding that, do the navigators do outreach? Can they take supplies to patients or people who don't have the necessary transportation maybe to come to the hospital and get them?
So our navigators right now don't do that, but First Steps is also working with the YMCA, and Tanya Barnett, there is their family navigator. They have a diaper bank, and she has been able to do some drop-offs. The health department also can. And so we try to work within the whole system to help get people what they need, where they need it. The nice thing, the reason that First Steps approached us is because a lot of times people come to their well child checks or they come to the doctor, and it's a common place to find families who might be in need that might not show up at other places. But yeah, that's a good point.
Thank you.
Next slide, please. So this is the slide I was thinking of before. It just outlines a little more about early life and how it really goes from, before you even think about becoming pregnant to conceiving, having a delivery, and then all the way through the second birthday. Below that, you see how the healthcare system fits into somebody's life, into both the mother's and the child's and the family's life with annual visits, prenatal care, and delivery. But next slide, please. But what we add on to that with some of our projects are the other projects that I've just talked about. So Upstream fits in before one becomes pregnant. We have the cribs for kids during prenatal care. You'll hear more about the food bags for moms at delivery. And then I talked a little bit about the diaper bank. You'll hear more about the VegRx program that we administer during our well child checks. And then I'll go on to talk a little bit more about child care, which of course is also part of early life. Next slide, please. So that comes to childcare. You probably remember that we've been giving out or helping with childcare subsidies throughout COVID, and we've gotten many thanks for that from our employees, and this is one of them. It's been really important to our staff. Next slide, please. So before I go back to the subsidies, I'll go to our work in expanding childcare capacity. You've heard a lot about that from us. Since the last time we spoke, we completed our childcare commerce grant work that we did last summer, and it culminated with a report called Caring for Our Future, East Jefferson County Rural Childcare Report, and you can find that on the Population Health webpage. It's a pretty quick 43-page read. It's pretty in-depth and has a lot of information. It was a lot of fun to do. It includes a needs assessment, feasibility study, and some site possibilities. Building on that, we then applied for the Washington State Department of Commerce Early Learning Facilities Grant. We'll be hearing about that this month, and the goal behind that would be to develop a facility where a childcare operator could run a business and therefore increase the childcare capacity in the county. We'll see how that goes. Jefferson County was kind enough to be a supporter on that grant and provided some of the matching funds, as did Jefferson Healthcare. We're excited to hear if we get that grant, and if we don't, we'll move on to Plan B or C possibly. The other thing that we're doing right now is looking for a childcare operator partner. So a letter just went out to the community asking if there is a childcare operator out there who would like to expand or start a new business that we could help support. So we're taking letters of interest right now, and those we'll be closing that next week and then start looking at who's applied or continue recruiting. The goal, again, is not for Jefferson Healthcare to run a childcare. Really, it's just to support a business that's able to expand the access to childcare for our county.
Is there any interest so far, Molly?
We've had a few people reach out, many with questions about, you know, is it a good fit for them? So we're having a lot of phone calls to answer those questions, and we'll see if something sticks. Next slide, please.
Molly, how much was the support provided by Jefferson Healthcare and or the county?
The county is matching us $290,000, and Jefferson Healthcare picked up the rest to meet the one-third matching. So I think it was up to around $50,000. We're required to have a third matching, and it's a $1 million grant. And Dunya put in the link in the chat the link to our report in case anyone would like a direct link. So back to the employee childcare support that's been going on through COVID. In 2021, the hospital was able to support families with a total of $55,000. We averaged about $4,600 a month. And we were able to support anywhere between 11 to 18 families per month and up to a max of 25 kids. And that was in June when the kids were out of school. So there were some older kids in childcare then. The median that we subsidized was $200 approximately. And the range was somewhere it ranged from $45 to $877 per month. So this was really meaningful support to our employees. And I just want to say that out loud and be really appreciative. There were people who told us that they would not have been able to continue working if that support had not been there. So thank you. Next slide, please. On to Tina for food.
Hi, thank you. So on the next slide, you will see all the initiatives we use to address food insecurity for our patients. And given the time, I'm just going to highlight three. So Amali spoke to VegRx, which connects local families to local produce from the Jefferson County Farmers Markets, both in Port Townsend and in Chimicum. And the 2021 market season was our most successful year ever. So grateful for all those providers who are moving those vouchers into families' hands. And we're going to go even bigger in 2022. So that's a nice partnership, nice strong partnership with the farmers markets. And we're going to just give out even more vouchers. So that feels really good. The next partnership I'll highlight is it's a new partnership with Peddler PT. And this program delivers food from the food bank to elders who can't get to the food bank on Saturdays. And so if they have any kind of transportation barriers, there's a local woman who will deliver food bank to their homes, and I'm looking for more uptake on this service, so I'm mentioning it every chance I get. So help me spread the word, and if any providers are listening, email me later. And then the third program I will highlight at the moment is the food bags. So this program allows any Jefferson Healthcare staff member to give a bag of food to a hungry patient at any encounter. And the bag contains about 2 to 3 days worth of food. And I will just say that during the last 15 plus months, a little bit more than a year, we moved over 3,500 pounds of food through this lovely little pantry. So that feels like a success story to me. And there's a story, of course, behind every bag of food that we give a patient. You know, there's a life story. And so many of those stories we'll never know. But on the next slide, you'll see a story from an oncology patient who shared their experience with us. And I'll just let you read through that. But generally, This patient was struggling to pay for both medical treatment and basic needs. And they were really grateful to get the food bag and a couple or three days worth of food. They were so grateful they were moved to tears. And just having that bag of food for that week allowed them to catch up on a few bills. And then they were connected to longer term resources. So just to paraphrase something Dr. Parker said earlier, I want to echo that. It really resonated with me. These programs start a conversation about food, but they also start the conversation about the other needs in the patient's life. So I'm happy to answer any questions you may have, or you can always email me about other programs if you want to hear more.
I think this slide says it all. What a wonderful thing to do for people. What a wonderful resource.
Do we happen to know whether any of our employees have food insecurity from a combination of unexpected or unmet financial circumstances?
Yeah, I think it's probably likely that they do. My core goal has been to support our patients so far, but we sure, it's a great question, and we could talk more about that with our HR team, I think.
Yeah, it's so easy to think that people who are unemployed are the people who have food insecurity, and yet with housing what it is and all kinds of other, and the cost of living.
And the cost of food locally, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think a lot of our families who struggle with food insecurity are actually employed and not even necessarily living below the poverty line, the federal poverty line. It's just that it's expensive to live here. And so they have to make tough decisions, especially if they're also trying to pay for medical care and balance a lot of different expenses.
Tina, have you come across people who maybe need some support funding to get to medical appointments across the water, as in gas coupons or finances for that sort of thing? I know back in the 80s, when it was pretty much of a struggle here in the early 80s, that was something that we often encountered, that our patients didn't have enough money to buy the gas to get across the other side. With inflation as it is, I wonder if that's an issue again.
Yeah, I think any program, any chance we you know, again, just to reiterate and echo Dr. Parker, these conversations about food kind of lead to other needs that patients have. And I'm going to bat this over to Dunya to talk about transportation specifically and the resources that her team have.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think transportation is one of the number one issues that the care navigators and the health navigators work on in the care coordination team. And Mari, it's not only across the water, it's getting up to Port Ludlow. It's getting from South County up here. It's a huge issue. So we've worked in the past with the Jefferson Healthcare Foundation to get gas cards and to get funding to those folks so they can put some money in their tank. But it's a huge issue right now. And because the public transportation is limited because of we're such a rural community, it makes it really hard.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tina. We only have 6 minutes, so I'm going to keep us moving along here. So we're going to talk a little bit about equity. And as I said, I promise to stay within our 30 minutes. So I'm going to go a little bit fast, but I think you hear from me a lot on this topic. So next slide. So this is our 2021 health equity sort of strategic plan, and it's it was ambitious, and yet we did a lot of it, not quite all of it, but a lot of it. So on the left-hand side in the second column, there are sort of our big bucket items, and those came from the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, the IHI, which we participated in. They're pursuing equity collaborative. And then these were sort of the projects, the tactics that we undertook there on the right. I put a red check mark next to the ones that we had accomplished in 2021. So we had a little bit more to do with staff and provider training. We had a little bit more to do there on the bottom with implementing business practices that support racial equity, including supporting local businesses owned by BIPOC community members. And I did think that we demonstrated leadership commitment to improving health equity 100%, especially with our SLG team who participated in all of the ATC calls. But I would like to continue to do that. So that is staying on the list for 2022, because I'd love to work with the leadership team at the director level to help train and get folks up to speed on that. And so I really think that we did a lot this last year. So whenever I think about how much we did, it was really an impressive year. And I appreciate everyone on the health equity team that worked on it with me, especially Tina, who was integral to all of this. Next slide, please. And so we were part of the IHI Pursuing Equity collaborative, and it was an 18-month engagement, and we have reached the end of it this month. We've reached 18 months, which is wild. I know. We've been doing this work for almost 2 years now, and so it makes sense. The middle circle here was those five sort of buckets they look at everything in, and they asked us to identify some accomplishments under each one of those. And I'll just pull out a few of them. So building infrastructure, one of the big pieces of building infrastructure is looking at the data and analytics piece. And we had dedicated analytics to all of this. And I talked about that in November with you as the board. We really integrated equity into all of our primary care and medical group quality metrics. We've looked at it across the board in terms of access and utilization. And so we've really had a chance to explore that and figure out what is going to come next. We also were able to get equity built into the 2022 strategic plan, and I think that it'll continue to be a key part of our strategic plan moving forward. We've stopped sending patients to collections during the COVID pandemic, and we've really done a lot of partnership in the community, especially with the JCIRA, the Jefferson County Immigrant Rights Advocates, around the COVID-19 vaccine in early 2021, which feels like a lifetime ago, but it really wasn't that long ago. So I think that this gave us an amazing sort of framework to start thinking through what our equity work is going to look like. And we are not done, of course. This is ongoing work. And the next group that we are a part of, next slide, please, Brittany, is WISHA. And so WISHA also has their own equity initiative that I talked a little bit about the last time we spoke. We have completed our first sprints, which is how they organize the work. They say, all right, we're going to talk, we're going to plan, and then you're going to do 90 days of really intense work around something around equity. And then you're going to come back and decide how did that work, do some PDSAs, all of that. Our first sprint was around data collection, which Jackie Levin, Alex Gee, and Tisha Davidson led for our registrars. And so ensuring that we are collecting the right data around race, ethnicity, and language as people were checking into Epic. And so they did that work. I think it went unbelievably well to help people get to the why of why they're asking those questions. And the next step to data collection to me is to optimize our data analytics. And so, as I said, we did a ton of work around analyzing all of the quality metrics, but that was using data that wasn't necessarily correct because we hadn't worked on the data collection part first. So the next step is to look at the data analytics again, look at better dashboards for the entire institution to use, see what should and can be made public to our community around what we're doing, and focus on that. And we're about 23 days into that first sprint now, and really starting to pick up that work with looking at the DART team to help lead at that part. Then we have 2 months off, 3 months off, and in September, we're going to do our third sprint, which we've decided probably to focus on clinical implementation. I think the reason that we're all here is to support patients and our providers. And so after we've collected the data, we've analyzed the data, the next step is to identify those key clinical priorities and really implement change around what happens in the clinics and make sure that all of our community is getting all the care that they need in the most appropriate way possible. And I'm really looking to Dr. Parker and Dr. Mattern, who are both on the Health Equity Committee, to help us lead that work as we move some of that forward. So that is yet to come, but we're not done. We have a lot of work ahead of us, and I think everyone is really committed. As I think you know, we had a great celebration with Black History Month. We are celebrating May as Asian American Pacific Islander Month, and so that work is undergoing. We'll have another Juneteenth celebration, and so we're just starting to get into a rhythm here with all of this work, and it's been really, really exciting.
Good.
And that is the end of our... Thanks. That is the end of our presentation. Are there any questions for any of us?
It says on the last slide, it said to close. Does that mean the job is finished and then will there be monitoring to make sure that things stay the way that they need to stay, or do you know?
So that closeout is actually the 18 months of the WISHA sprint. And so WISHA's, or the WISHA engagement. So WISHA's engagement is also 18 months. So after we are done sort of engaging in these multiple sprints, essentially WISHA is going to say that, you know, now you've graduated, you can implement health equity initiatives on your own. And so this is our chance to be part of a big collective. But our work internally will not stop. We will continue to do PDSAs and reevaluate the data and find new things that we need to be working on, new partnerships that we need to make in the community.
Great. Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Well, thank you, Dunia and Dr. Parker and Tina.
I do want to say, if I could, Jill, that as a member of the board serving on the committee, it's just really been awesome to see the dedication and the amazing work that our staff has done in the midst of a COVID pandemic. I mean, my God, you know, everybody is overworked already, and yet the dedication to this has just been remarkable.
What I think is particularly enjoyable about this work is that it's work that, particularly on the social determinants of health side, everybody can get really excited about, and it's rewarding and meaningful, and it feels at the person you're sitting across from important and reasonable, and it's foundational to our very conscious and deliberate shift from the fee for service methodology of paying for sick care to beginning to work outside of the hospital footprint, work on elevating community health and wellness, and begin position the community and the organization for the days when our payers will pay us for well care, will pay us for the outcome of quality care, and a well population. And when we first started looking at this several years ago, it was daunting because, you know, oh my God, there's so much work to do. Where do you start? Well, literally start by handing a hungry person a bag of food and keep working and working and working and looking for partners, making application for grants. So you got a heavy dose of the social determinants of health portion of their work, and it's an important portion, but tightly connected to the organizational goal of positioning for a population health pivot that I think we'll all see.
Thank you. Healthcare has a lot more in it than just medicine. And this, you know, it's so gratifying to see that Jefferson Healthcare really is doing more than that. Thank you all for your dedication and your passion, and from the entire community. I wish we could get this out to the community more so that they know these resources that are available. I think it would be wonderful if we could have some sort of an article or something to let people know what's available and what we're doing to help even more people in our community. Thank you. Any other comments? Case, you're muted. I saw your hand go.
It would also be great to get Dunia and Molly on the road and have them present to the Rotary Clubs and other organizations so that those folks can help spread the word, and so that people understand how much we really do here as a keystone organization in this community.
Which might also help support some of these programs. As Sunrise Rotary supports the first baby bags going home, food bags. So that's a good avenue.
Sounds great. We're there. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Bob. And we better move on now to our next is Home Health and Hospice Quarterly Update with our Executive Director, Tammy Tarsa. Tammy, welcome.
Thank you. And just as a to preface my slides, these slides were taken from a presentation I did with my staff. We have a monthly what I call TAMI time, where I just we talk about a given topic. It's a way for their voice to be heard and for them to engage in decisions. So this was presented in February, and there are a lot of hearts involved. So just so you know. All right, next slide, please. And some of this is going to be a little bit of review. You have the full presentation in your board packet, and I've just targeted a few slides to spend a little bit extra time on. And so this is focusing on home health. This was our admissions per month. On the bottom, you'll see that we have a total number of episodes for 2021 with 719. So Medicare, within home health, Medicare says we have 60-day benefits, but we have two 30-day billing periods within each of those 60-day benefits. So when we say we had 719 episodes, it could be a 30-day period, it could be two 30-day periods, but that is how we're paid. And you can see the transition and the decline when the different variants hit. So next slide, please. And please let me know if you have any questions. I'm gonna breeze through this quickly. So I think I mentioned the last time I spoke with you that home health has a complex billing model. And I gave you some stats when I spoke with you last, but this is the updated. So this is looking at the full year of 2021. And so one of the things that Medicare looks at when they're determining how much they're gonna reimburse us for that 30-day billing period, they're looking at, did the referral come from the community or did it come from an institution? So we are reimbursed more when the referrals come from the hospital or when they come from a life care center. So it just shows you the where most of our referrals are coming from, which is right now the community. Next slide, please. The second thing they look at is the episode timing. So is this what we call a research? So they were on for 60 days and now we're gonna put them on for another 60 days. We are reimbursed less for those. If a patient is discharged from our services and comes back on within a certain length of time, that is considered, again, a late episode, and we're reimbursed less for those. So really looking at the timing of our patients, we just went through a Department of Health survey. They showed up at our door a couple weeks ago. It went really well, and I'll just touch base on that at the end. But it was interesting to see they look at unduplicated admissions, and then they look at readmissions. And our unduplicated admissions were 456. Our readmissions were 353. So, you know, we have a daily bed meeting, and we're sitting in that meeting talking about the referrals and admitting them. And I'm like, that name sounds familiar. That name sounds familiar. And they do sound familiar because we're just, a lot of times we're just recycling the same patients. And so figuring out a way to better manage that care, so we can have them on home health, discharge them, and let them be successful in the community for a period of time would be great. Work to do and opportunities out there. Next slide, please.
How does that readmission relate to other agencies that do the same kind of work?
So within Jefferson County, we are the only home health agency. The state of Washington is a certificate of need, so there are no other agencies that provide home health services. Certainly, there are agencies that also bill Medicare Part A, which is how we bill. For example, a nursing home, a skilled nursing facility, we cannot have patients on home health services that reside in life care because of the different services and the different way they bill. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, though, you said 300 of the 400, and I'm just wondering, do we know, is that higher than what we should expect, or is that okay, or is that lower?
Yeah, you're looking at the average. And right. I don't have the answer to that. I don't know. It seems high to me because when I'm looking at the readmissions, I mean, I'll see patients within the year 2021 that were on our services five times. So someplace there is a break in their health care. The way the Medicare system is set up is that our job in home health is to go in, give them a service, and then discharge. We're intermittent short-term care. And what we find is that a lot of our patients need a higher level of care. So they need to be in a facility. Maybe they need private duty caregivers because they would be able to function at home if they took their medications, but medication management is not a skilled need. So we can't maintain in their home for those types of services. You know, they need a weekly lab draw or a UA that needs to be done to make sure that their catheters, you know, they're not getting an infection. Those things are not skillable. So we go in, we do what we can, we discharge, they stop taking their medications or any number of things, and then they bounce into the ED, into the hospital, and right back to home health. So the next thing they look at is the comorbidity adjustment. This is one of the areas where we have a huge potential to increase our reimbursement. Medicare has what they call groupers, and the way you group the diagnoses provides for increased reimbursement. And you can see that the majority of our patients, we have no comorbidities, and that's not true. I mean, they have lists of comorbidities, and so it's figuring out what the right equation is to list those comorbidities is what we're working on. And we currently have two staff going through an intense training to help gain that knowledge to help facilitate an improvement in this measure. Next slide, please. Functional impairment is one of those areas that we have been working really hard on, and we've seen a lot of improvement over the last year. So we are paid more for those individuals that have a high functional impairment. So they need assistance to eat, they need assistance to dress, they need assistance to transfer. So those patients were reimbursed more for. And so we've been working, we look at the accuracy of our documentation, and we are comparing it across the different disciplines that are in to see that patient prior to submitting the information to Medicare. So we've seen some great strides in this. Next slide, please. So this is the patient data grouping model that I was talking about, and it's the lead diagnosis. So this slide just tells you where most of our patients fall. So the majority of our patients come in with a therapy need. Neural stroke is next, and cardiac is our third highest. You'll see that wound comes in about mid-average, and wound care is, although it reimburses really well, it's also the biggest suck on resources because we are mandated to provide all of the wound care supplies. Often those patients need to be seen multiple times a week as well. So next slide, please. And then our LUPA threshold is the last thing that affects our reimbursement rate. When Medicare looks at all of those factors, they determine that you should see this patient 5 times or 2 times or 6 times. And if we see a patient less than that in a 30-day period, we get what we call a LUPA. It's a low utilization. And so rather than reimbursing us by the allotted amount, so rather than, say, reimbursing us $2,600 for that 30-day period, they are going to reimburse us strictly for those visits that we did. And it's a much lower rate, so they may pay us $200 for the visit. And so we try to avoid LUPAs at all cost. Our total average LUPA for 2021 was 12%. Next slide, please. All right, any questions on home health? And again, there are more detailed slides in your packet. All right, so moving on to just some information about hospice. Again, admissions per month, you can see that we were pretty busy toward the end of the year. Our census currently is at 34 today. Unduplicated admissions was 176 for the annual. Next slide, please. So hospice, I've said this before, but hospice is paid differently than home health. Home health is paid per episode, hospice is paid per day. So when we're looking at sustainability and how to better meet the financial needs of our department, we're looking at the number of days that we have on service. And so we want our patients to be on service for a number of reasons. We know that patients who are on our services for 30 to 60 days, they get the best care. We have an opportunity to go in, manage their symptoms, provide some pre-grief support, and really get the family and patient ready for what's going to happen at the end of life in the passing. And then it's also better for us financially. So looking at the median length of stay was 18 and a half days. Average length of stay is 43.6. Those are better this year than they were last year. They're higher this year than they were last year. Next slide, please. Terminal diagnoses don't impact the reimbursement like they do in home health, but it is interesting. I think it's interesting anyway, so you get to see it. It's interesting to see where our terminal diagnoses are. And you can see that cancer oncology is our highest user of our services. Next slide, please. All right, any questions on hospice specific?
All right. Yeah, quick question.
Yes.
A physician has to certify that they are within how many months?
6 months.
Six months.
And what we know, research shows us that patients who are on palliative or who are on hospice services tend to live longer than those patients with the same diagnoses who are not on hospice. We take such good care of our patients and we provide symptom management that they're able to live not even just fuller lives, but able to live longer.
So is there a financial penalty if the patient lives 9 months?
No, there's not. Now, there is, if we have a patient that's on our services for 3 years, that will red flag Medicare, and they might want to take a closer look at that. They might do an audit of that. But we do have patients that have been on, I think the length of stay was 322 days, so not quite 3 years, but pushing a year. And as long as we're able to document continued decline, then we can keep that patient. And after the third benefit period, every time we recertify them, keep them on longer, the medical director has to do what we call a face-to-face and again recertify that that patient is terminal. So there are hoops that we have to jump through, but no, there's no ding.
Are you finding some resistance on the part of patients for being put on hospice because they then think, oh my gosh, I've now been given a death sentence for 6 months from now?
Yeah, one of the challenges with hospice is people hear the word hospice and they think that that means death is imminent, and that's not the case. And, you know, as a hospice provider, I believe truly that death can be a beautiful part of your life. You can work through all of the trials and all of the challenges and make it something special, but that's not how a lot of other people view that, which is a great segue into palliative care, because the palliative care program works with those patients who are most often hospice eligible, but are not yet at the mindset or the emotional place where they are ready to accept hospice. So our nurse practitioner goes in and she has really in-depth conversations about end of life and what are your goals for end of life and what are you hope to accomplish, and really helps the patient get to that next place. Any other questions on hospice before I transition on? All right, so palliative care, next slide, please. So when I first arrived here at Jefferson, we had a pilot palliative care program, and it was embedded within our home health program. And there were a couple challenges with that. The first is that in order to service our patients, they had to meet eligibility requirements for home health, which mean they needed to have a skilled need and they had to be homebound. And what we know is that our palliative care patients they don't always meet those eligibility requirements. So that was the first challenge. The second challenge was that we kept them on home health anyway, which is really bad. We can't do that. We have to maintain the integrity of the Medicare benefit. So one of the things that I pushed for right away was the implementation of a palliative care program. We're very fortunate here in Jefferson County that we are rural, and so we have our rural health clinics, and which allows us to bill for the visit. So we're able to bill as if we're in a visit in the doctor's office, but we're in the patient's home. And that's been a huge benefit for this program. Other programs that I've worked at, we are not able to do that. So we eat the cost of the visit, knowing that the nurse practitioners are having these really important conversations with our patients, and we're bringing them on to hospice sooner. So we're fortunate that we have the front door end on the reimbursement and that we're able to see these patients and bill for those services. But you'll see in a couple slides that we're also gaining on the back end, because our patients are coming on to hospice sooner, and the length of stay for our patients on palliative care that transition to hospice is actually longer, and that's really good. And as I said, the length of stay is a direct correlation with the care that they get. So over the year 2021, as a reminder, this was the first year, 2021, we hired our nurse practitioner in January. We saw our first patient in March. So over the year, we've had 90 referrals, 61 patients we have admitted onto our program. 18 of those patients that we had referrals for were non-admits. Three of them passed prior to admission. At the time of this, six of those were scheduled. We discharged 16 of those to hospice, transitioned them to our program. Two were discharged back to their primary care provider, two moved, and then three passed on palliative care. And again, at the time of this report, we had 38. We currently have a census of 40. Next slide, please. So if you look at how our referrals came in, you can see that we were pretty busy in July, really busy in October, and then December was a pretty good month. But other than the month of August, which is a odd month, the number of referrals, we just see an increase in that, which has been great. And we're 3 months into the new year, and we have those high referrals as well. In fact, we're implementing strategies to really look at those patients that most need palliative care services, because we're getting a lot of referrals. I see a hand.
Yeah. So if palliative care is the care is very similar to hospice care, I'm just curious, how do they compare in terms of reimbursement?
So sure. And palliative care is, so what we say is that all care, both hospice and palliative care, is palliative, but not all palliative care is hospice. So the difference between the two programs is that when you're on hospice, we are no longer seeking treatment. When patients are on palliative care, they are allowed to continue to seek treatment. And so that's the biggest differentiator. Reimbursement is very different. So we are paid here in this organization, we're actually paid as if you're going to a doctor's office visit. So it's a per visit allotment. Next slide, please. So the length of stay on palliative care is 1 to 195 days. Median is 20, and our average is about 35 days. Renee sees, on average, the patients 4.4 times through this year. Next slide, please. So 26% of our patients on palliative care transition to hospice, which feels like a really big win for me. Our non-palliative care hospice patients' average length of stay was 40 days, 39.5, but our length of stay for our palliative care patients that transition to hospice, the average length of stay was 51.6, which is awesome. Next slide, please. And then the added benefit, because so many of these patients really are hospice appropriate, but they just are not emotionally ready, we send Renee in and she builds that relationship. So when that patient does reach that point, she can maintain in on the case and become the attending provider. And that has been a great benefit. And 60% of our palliative care patients that transition to hospice are keeping what we call our hospice medical group in Renee. Next slide, please. All right, any questions on palliative care? All right, moving on. 2022, just a brief overview. I'm not going to read through the slide. I'll let you do that on your own, but just touching base on all of the things that we are working on in 2022. So a couple things to highlight because they are on this list. When the Department of Health came a couple weeks ago, we were cited on two things. The first was our referral to admission. Medicare states that we have 48 hours once we receive a referral to admit a patient onto our services. That is challenging when everything is just splendid. When life is not as splendid due to staffing, then it's a little bit more difficult. And so there are loopholes. And so managing processes for those loopholes so that you remain compliant is one of the things that is listed in our QAPI for 2022. And it was something we were cited on. So there you go. The second thing that we were cited on was following the plan of care. So our clinicians work under physician orders, and the citation we received was related to visit frequency. So if we tell a physician that our nurses are going to see a patient once a week for 6 weeks, then we are obligated to provide that care once a week times 6 weeks. If for any reason we don't provide that care, we have to get an order for that. And we were cited on that. So that is also something that we are working on. And I can honestly say that that was a shocker to me. So you will not see that one on the list because this list was made before that, but it is something that we are currently working on. All right, next slide, please. So same thing, I'll let you read this on your own, but these are the specific aspects of hospice that we will be focusing on as we work through 2022 and move into the beginning of 2023. Next slide, please. Again, palliative care. Although we're all under one department, we have separate measures for each of our programs. Palliative care is still new, and so we have fewer things to work on. One of the biggest is bringing an MA in to help our nurse practitioner, and we have a candidate. I'm checking references now, so hopefully that will go through. And then some discussion on whether we bring in a second provider, very part-time, to help ease some of the burden and admit some additional patients to our palliative care program. Next slide, please. So this is not in 22, but I pulled it out because I think it's an important slide to mention, and then just stuck it in where I thought best. So it will appear different in your set of slides. But we had a total turnover of 35% in 2021. We hired 9 RNs. And so when you think that an RN takes 90 days just for orientation, and then really we say home health and hospice, you need a good year under your belt to be really competent, particularly if you're coming in without home health experience. That's just a huge number of nurses. And again, OT, MSW, aides, office staff, our nurse practitioners. So there are not a lot of disciplines that weren't impacted by new hires. Next slide, please. So our current staffing situation, we are down 3 nurses, 3 full-time nurses, 1.6. We have 3 open per diem nurses, a couple aides, although right this moment I'm feeling really hopeful because I spoke with a good candidate today for an aide. We are still looking for that MA, although I have doing reference checks on one. And then we have a PAR, which is our biller. So all of the billing that we do that happens in home health and hospice actually happens in home health and hospice. We do our own billing. So we are currently using a temp biller and you know, she's temp, and so any moment she could resign. And so we're hoping to get that position filled, but haven't had a whole lot of luck. All right, and I think that's the last one. Is that the last one, Brittany? Yeah, it is. Perfect. Any questions?
Mari? Yeah.
What would be the reason that a visit was not carried out? Would it be the patient didn't need it, or short staffing, or?
Right. So short staffing is not usually the reason. And I say that because it seems like it would be. but we're really careful about only admitting the number of patients that we can serve. Our situation is different than the hospitals in that people go to the hospital and they have to be served, and we actually accept referrals. So one of the things we're doing at those bed meetings every day is looking at our staffing and how can we serve this patient? And so really prioritizing and triaging them. So, but reasons for the missed visit would be that the patient wasn't home. The patient had a doctor's visit that took precedence over that. They were home, but they didn't hear us. And so they didn't answer their door. Weather related incidents, that would be another staffing. And as I said, there are ways to get around that. We just have to let the physician know. But the glitch is we didn't always let the physician know. So we were outside of the orders for the plan of care.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, with fully 50% of healthcare institutions in Washington State currently run by Catholic institutions, there are a growing number of people who are concerned about the safety of secular healthcare, meaning healthcare that is not being limited by the Catholic bishops' ERDs or ethical and religious directives. Mm-hmm. I was recently asked to talk about that, and just for the record, in case we have community people who want to listen, I would love to have you speak to the array of services that we provide for end-of-life care so that people can be assured that we are offering all of the options allowed under secular health care.
Sure. So we get, as I spoke, we have our palliative care program and we have our hospice program, but we also participate with Death with Dignity. There are specific rules. We do not actually, we do not help the patient ingest the medications for Death with Dignity, and we're not in the home when they're doing so, but we will help facilitate. We will make the connections with the Death with Dignity program. We will work with patients as they're making those plans. We will go to the patient's home when they're going to ingest the medication. We will step outside while they do so, and we will immediately go back in once that's completed and be with them as they pass. So we are there through the full array of the Death with Dignity process.
And our providers will provide the prescriptions required?
Dr. Mattern, as our medical director, is really good at meeting with patients and providing that service. Yes.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes.
Quick question about that. That detail of stepping outside at that moment, is that by law or is that just our policy?
No, that is required.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you, Tammy. Very thorough and exhaustive. It's amazing all the things that are going on and what you've done. Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
And we will now recess until 3:30. See you all back for the business meeting. Thank you. All right. Welcome back to the business portion of the March 23rd, 2022 Jefferson County Public Hospital District No. 2 Board of Commissioners meeting. Well, we begin with one of our favorite subjects, and that's the revealing of the team, employee, and provider of the quarter. So Allison Crispin, our interim Chief Human Resources Officer, will present the well-deserved awards to our honorees. Allison?
Yes, hi, we're so happy. And oh, I see that our employee of the quarter has just popped on with Mitzi. Her name is Marisa Jenkins, and she's our employee of the quarter. She's a care team specialist too. She works out of rehab. And we've heard a lot about Marisa lately. She has an incredible professionalism and calmness and warmth to her as she greets our patients each and every day. She has been known to walk out into the parking lot to help unsteady patients get through the door. She maintains a calm even in the face of people being very upset or needing help. She sort of emotionally high-fives her coworkers by leaning in and saying, good job. And she takes the quality of her work incredibly seriously. And she's a huge asset to the team. And she just makes the day at rehab. So thank you, Marisa.
Thank you very much, everybody. I feel honored, and I just really love my job here at Jefferson Healthcare. So thank you very much.
And she deserves every word and more of what they wrote about her. She's wonderful.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, great. And so we will go to our provider of the quarter. And that is Dr. Forbes. Yay, Dr. Forbes. So, Dr. Forbes's nominator wrote that he is one of two providers in the medical group that is prescribing oral therapeutics for our COVID positive patients. And he volunteered to do this and work through the kinks of the process and come into the clinic on his day off multiple times to treat these patients with constant workflow changes. He really worked through all the issues in regards to this process. He's shown great professionalism when working with other teams like pharmacy and COVID nurses, passes on information, and in general, everybody knows him to be a wonderful provider and caregiver to our patients. Thank you, Dr. Forbes.
Thank you, Dr. Forbes.
Thank you very much. Well, it's an honor, and I, as always, am proud to be part of this organization.
Well, Dr. Forbes, I can speak from my husband's point of view. You were such a great provider in helping him with his back issue. I endorse this nomination and your award and recognition. Can't say enough about how you took care of my husband. Thank you.
Say hi, Bill.
Thank you, Dr. Forbes.
And so for our next, we have the team of the quarter, and it's our incredible EVS team. I don't think anybody can argue this nomination at all, and we're so excited that they're here. And I know that Nicole is on the line, who's the leader of the EVS team. And here's what their nominator had to say. And they said that this one team stands out for them. It's EVS. This group of employees receives an assignment or work area every day to work and are often called away. I have seen them leave their regularly scheduled work to come to the ACU often. They come willing and with a smile. They are always ready to help, and it doesn't matter what help is needed. Often we think of EVS as housekeeping, but with this group of employees, it's something so much more. They are at the ready to help with a mess and at the ready to help move things about the unit. If you need something not available in the ACU, call EVS. They will bring and set up things like bed extenders and are always available to help bring medical equipment that's not always used on the third floor. Each and every member of our EVS staff is always on top of it. They are always quick to respond, even when I know they are slammed. They are so appreciated.
That is great. Congratulations. Every one of you and our provider and our employee of the quarter sets the bar higher. You just are so inspirational to our entire employees, our entire staff. Thank you so much from the community and from the hospital district. You're amazing people, and well done.
You've just got to walk into our establishment and see all the hard work you do, because it is generally spotless, and that's thanks to all of you. Thank you.
And the EVS team are also, they are ambassadors for our patients, because they're, you know, whenever I've been in the hospital, you folks are the ones that I really rely on for making sure that everything's where it's supposed to be, and it's always spotless, and you're great conversationalists too.
pardon my ignorance, but what does EVS stand for?
Environmental Services.
Environmental Services. Yes, important to everything, isn't it?
Yep.
So in speaking of raising the bar, we added a category to our people of the quarter, and it's our leader of the quarter. And so our leader of the quarter is Jacob Stokes, who is our leader of our lab, our incredible lab that has worked insane hours over the last couple of years. And Jacob has actually been covering the night shift for the last few months as his team has been short and had already he was already picking up extra days to work the bench. He is led by example by jumping in to cover the unfilled spots to keep the lab up and running through the nights. And some of these nights are as long as 14 hours. And I know that he's working the day after as well. He is always there for us no matter what. His door is always open, and I personally know that if I have a problem, Jacob will listen and will come up with a solution. I've witnessed many situations when people were upset and went to talk with him and came out smiling, knowing that everything is going to be okay. Jacob is a great leader, technologist, and a caring supervisor. I have witnessed many techs, including myself, coming back to the lab because of Jacob and his leadership. For the first time in my almost 20 years long career, I feel appreciated and valued. We are grateful to have Jacob as our leader. Thank you, Jacob.
Thank you.
Way to go, Jacob. Fabulous. You work so hard. Yeah. It's a challenge.
The lab is always this very important nexus of critical, timely hospital and care-based information. But if you think about every PCR COVID test went through the laboratory, either actually done on-site, the ones we needed to turn around quickly, or processed and sent away and put it into Epic, and providing information first thing the next morning about the list of positives that needed to be contacted. So it was a task that might not have been in Jacob's job description of the typical lab director, but it was one of those during COVID other duties as assigned, and he stepped up and led his team and just did remarkable work.
Well done.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you, Jacob.
Thank you.
Okay, well, that's always invigorating and exciting to see the people that are really, really doing an outstanding job. And our entire staff is wonderful, but these, like we say, are even setting the bar even higher. So thank you all. You're appreciated. Then we will move on to the minutes, much more mundane. So we have the minutes of the February 16th and the minutes of the February special session and February 23rd regular session. Is there a move to approve?
So move.
Second.
All right. Any discussion? All in favor, please raise your hand. Okay, it's unanimous. Minutes are approved as written. Required approvals. Is there any anything that anybody would like to take out to discuss separately? If not, may I have a motion to approve?
So move.
Second.
All right. Moved and seconded. Is there discussion? If not, all in favor, raise your hands, please. Okay. Thank you. Unanimously.
Can I ask Mari a question, please, about one of the things that was in there?
Sure.
It talked about the amion OB, A-M-I-O-N. Do you happen to know what that means?
Amnion OV?
Yes.
Amnion is one of the membranes in the...
Yes, but...
But I don't, I'm not familiar with that.
Actually, it's M-I-O-N. It's our system that monitors physicians on call. Am I on call?
Am so I that's, on that, call? Oh, great.
It's different than a uterine like a membrane.
Thank you.
All right. If there's no more discussion, then we will go on to our financial report with Tyler Freeman, our chief financial officer. Tyler, how are we doing?
unfortunately, we're looking pretty close to the wave that we did in January, but similar to January, it's not all as bad as it may appear. And we are looking better in March, which I'll show on the final slide. So next slide. So to start off, these first numbers here on operating statistics, I don't know that most of us would notice too much of a difference from the month of January, which is the inpatient side is full, where they are over budget, 21% over budget for patient days. But the outpatient and the surgeries, the clinic side, the care that's more elective in nature is still down. And it's still down for some of the same reasons that we had in January. Having some of those elective procedures pushed off, having surgery not kind of at full force. Also, staffing issues impacted us a little bit. Some of the departments were still, we budgeted for having people in place that we just have not been able to get in yet. And so once we are able to, and once we kind of stabilize the staffing side of it, we'll be able to see the revenue gains that we expected as well. So overall, like I said, this looks almost the ones that were red this month were red last month. So we're kind of looking pretty close to where we landed for the month of January. And the thing that is really interesting is this can kind of show you how important those outpatient, those elective, those clinic procedures are, because we did have 21% is significantly more patient days than what we budgeted for. But when we go to the next slide and look at revenue, we were still 12% below our budget for gross patient service revenue. So the amount of bodies in the house isn't what drives our bottom line revenue number. It's definitely the outpatient side, and having those specialty visits and the clinic visits are what drive a lot of the ancillary services, the labs, the imaging, the pharmacy medications, those types of things all are downstream impacts of those other types of visits. So overall, 12% below our gross patient service revenue budget. Our other revenue is still high. We still have the money rolling in from last year that we have that we're recognizing over the full course of 2022. So that's still in there. So overall, operating revenues were 7% above our budget. And the expenses, unfortunately, unlike January, kind of caught up with us a little bit. So salaries and wages, 11% over what we budgeted. $315,000 of that is the 2 months worth of ratification bonus that was included in the ProTech and clinic contract that was approved. So we have 2 full months of that hit in the month of February. And that was a pretty significant impact. And we also have a lot of traveler expenses as we're trying to plug staffing holes right now too. And that's what's rolling through some of the other expenses lines. But given all of those kind of roadblocks, we still are just a hair over for in the black for a change in net position for the month, and at $553,000 in net income for the year. And when you compare that to where we landed at February 2021 year to date, we are in a much better spot. The only thing that I will caveat that with is, unlike 2021, we don't expect to have a lot more CARES funding rolling through at the end of the year like we did in 2021. So we do definitely need to continue to see improvement, and we've seen some of that come through in March so far. If you go to the next slide, We have our days in AR and days in cash. So the you'll notice our green line there, which is the cash that is net of what we expect to receive or pay to CMS at the end of the year, has started to switch over. So in at the end of 2021, we were expecting to have a big payback to Medicare, and now we're starting to see those two kind of mirror each other. So we don't have that expectation of a big payable or receivable, but it is starting to swing to a receivable side, and that's what happens when you're when your costs are increasing, but your charges are not, you start to move into the space where CMS is likely going to pay you at the end of the year instead of you have to pay them. So we're hoping that with our increases in charges, those will get pretty close to even, and there won't be a big swing one way or the other. And we've also seen days in AR at the end of the month were trending upwards in January as well. And that was some staffing related pieces that we are really excited to have a HIM manager on board now that just started this week. And we have some coders that have started as well. So we're hoping that that number is going to continue to trend down, and it has already started to in March. And on the next slide, we have the board financial report. And there is pretty much nothing to note on the board financial report. We had the only expenses were, wages and benefits, as we expected. So nothing really to talk about with board finances. And then on the next slide, we have March. And as I said, March, thankfully, is starting to trend in a much better direction. We've seen that increase in surgeries. We've seen the increase in pharmacy as a result of some of those. So we're starting to see that our charges are finally starting to be ahead of budget. Right now, the expectation through Epic is that those are going to land at 106% of our budget. And we'll start to see as those charges have increased and our coding days start to go down and we're getting the bills out the door faster, we'll start to see that cash collections number increase as well. So having the lower than expected revenue for the first few months has impacted that cash collection rate because we just aren't charging as much as we thought we would have and what we budgeted for. So now that we're starting to see that increase in charges, we'll hopefully start to see the collections go up as well. And one of the other things to note with our days cash is that number too is also being slightly impacted by just our costs. So our costs overall, it cost when we were reporting out at the end of 2021, it was about one day's worth of cash was $370,000 of expenses, and that's already bumped up to $383,000 for this year. So it'll we're right at budget, but if we continue to hire, we continue to have double time travelers, other things like that, that number is just going to keep creeping up on us. So we're in that kind of a stage where I would say we're cautiously optimistic that things are going to trend better, but we do know that costs are definitely going to increase in 2022. So we need to hopefully see that that increase in charges as well. Okay. So any questions?
Yeah. Tyler, could you give some indication as to how many positions are open at Jefferson Healthcare in human resources?
In human resources?
No. Well, what is the total number of positions that they're looking to fill?
I think the total count is a little bit elusive just because we do have some positions that are posted for multiples. So we have ones where we have posted them as a a full-time, a part-time, a per diem, just hoping to get anybody. But right now, the overall count is around 150, and our FTE count is closer to 100. But that number adjusted down based on our gross charges and our expectations is closer to 20. So that's obviously flexed down by the our own internal expectation of what we thought we were going to have in terms of volumes. And since those volumes haven't been there, that adjusts the overall FTE down quite a bit.
Hey, Case, that's an important question. It's one we spend a lot of time staring at, but it's a real complicated one. How about if I ask Allison to get back with the board in next month or the following month with how we are managing that? Because a bunch of those positions are per diems, and does five per diems hold the same weight as one mammotech? And so we're trying to figure that out and then do it in a way that's standard to other organizations so we can benchmark, because everybody is being challenged by workforce issues now. But we'll get back to you. We'll try to get back to you next week with that data.
Yeah, I think that's just an important thing, again, for the community to understand, that it's a tight market. It's tough. And yeah.
I think another thing that comes up in the community that I hear is, they hear a big number like 120, and they think that many people have left. Oh. And that's not the case. That's what we would love to have. That's what we're trying to hire towards. But that doesn't mean that many people have quit or retired, for whatever reason.
There's a lot of growth in that too. We have a lot of departments that have the expected community need is out there, and so we need to grow to match that community need.
Although this year more than any other year, Jill, it truly it's in all of the above that the turnover in the healthcare industry. These last couple of years, that data is just now coming out, and there was a significant uptick in healthcare, and particularly in hospitals, for all the same reasons as the Great Resignation, and frankly, even easier to understand reasons given the grind folks have been through. But I think we saw a greater uptick in early retirements, a greater uptick in resignations, relocating to going back home, other place, all of the above, which created a bigger slice than what we normally see in people leaving Jefferson Healthcare. Add to that, all of these new jobs that we created, we stood up like 19 jobs when we did the vaccination clinic. We stood up, 10, 12 jobs of temperature checkers, all of this, all of the COVID infrastructure that we've created were sort of added jobs as well. So it's a tough issue to really get a precise answer on, other than I think we have work to do as an industry and as a hospital in our recruiting and making working at Jefferson Healthcare a wonderful experience. It's a focus of ours this year.
Yeah, very complicated. Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Tyler?
No. Not a question, but Tyler, it looks like from this graph that's up that you are putting your report together at midnight.
No, you mean the updated as of time?
Yeah, the timestamp on there.
No. That's just the as of Epic's last update.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Tyler, for the report, and we'll look forward to to you next report, see how we're doing. So the next item of business is our administration report by Chief Financial Officer Mike. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you. Next slide, Brittany. So volumes, I suppose if there's a good line to see tumbling down, it's this one. It'll be kind of fascinating to chart this over the last 2 years and see how closely it ties to community prevalence. Well, my hunch would be probably pretty closely. But COVID-related calls and have continuing to trend down, which I think is a sign consistent with just what's happening in the community. Next slide. Primary care volumes are hanging in about a little below 95%. We're experiencing some staffing issues in some of the clinics, and so we curtailed some services in order to make the care environment better for patients and staff alike. And I think that as staffing catches up, we will see those numbers continue to grow. Specialty clinics, kind of this continued uptick to as more and more patients now are interested in seeking their elective surgical case that might have been recommended to them a couple of months ago, and now they are in the queue. Next slide, please. Cancer cases. I mean, whenever there's a downtick in cancer, I usually say that this is due to anything other than there's less disease in our community. This service continues to grow, and the good news is most of that growth is patients seeking care locally and not leaving town, as opposed to the cancer rate increasing in our population. And then surgical volumes, you could sort of see the cap on 88-86%, which was during the governor's proclamation, and that has been turned off, and we are very busy down there. I think I heard 14 cases today. So Donica and her crew are racing to try to keep up with pent-up demand. Next slide. And this is the emergency department and express clinic. Emergency department's blue, express clinic's kind of brown. And that number has been kind of bouncing around. We did see this fairly significant drop sort of in both areas after this period where they were really challenged. And what this doesn't capture is length of stay. In any given day, there might be two, as many as three patients waiting for transfer to a specialty hospital. That's not uncommon to last 2 to 3 days as we scramble and call, in some cases, every adolescent psychiatric hospital in the state trying to find a bed. So sometimes these low volumes don't represent the amount of activity that is going on in the emergency department and the amount of care that's necessary. Next slide. I'm going to ask Dunya to go through the advocacy slide, but before I do, I probably should have mentioned this at the beginning of the board meeting. Today is day one of our DNV annual survey, they are just winding down virtual surveys. So we have three surveyors who are, one's in Georgia, one's in Virginia, and I forgot where the other one is, but they are beaming in, and we walk around with our iPads and show them different parts of the hospital, and they do a heavy and deep and intense medical record and chart and policy review. And right now, it would not surprise me if a handful of the leadership team signed off of the board meeting, because day one's review of the survey is going on right now. So that's why some people might be dropping off. But anyway, Dunya led all of our advocacy positioning work over the last couple of months in Olympia, and is also doing some very important work with our federal delegation. So I asked her to kind of give a quick summary of what happened last session. Dunya?
Thanks, Mike. So the legislative session adjourned last Thursday, two Thursdays ago, March 10th, after a short session, which was 60 days of the longest session I've ever done before. I appreciate everyone here working with us and moving some of this work forward. So a really high level overview. It was a really, really busy session, which means I just chose a few bills to put in here. There was tons more that we could talk about. Bills that passed this session. HB 1616, which was Charity Care Act, and so that was a pretty large statewide expansion of charity care. WISHA was able to get us into two different tiers for hospitals. We fall within the second tier, so the smaller rural hospitals, and quite frankly, our charity care policy is so robust anyways that we aren't going to see big changes, but it was a pretty big deal for the entire state. It came, actually, the AG's office was involved in getting that moved forward, so there's a lot of negotiating with that office. HB 1735, which if you remember last year, there was a bill that had passed that had unintended consequences, where it was trying to look at the amount of force that police can use or peace officers can use. And it ended up resulting in police officers saying that they couldn't really get involved in helping people in behavioral health crises get treatment or helping manage those people. And so then it left a lot of our EMS staff, it left a lot of behavioral health staff sort of in the lurch, where they couldn't help these patients whenever they were in a crisis and were potentially violent. So this bill clarified that use of force. And so now those folks are able to partner with the police force to help people get to the treatment that they need. 5600 is looking at expanding state registered apprenticeship programs, which I think is really important. One of the buckets that they are looking to expand is around healthcare and behavioral health specifically. It also has a few grant programs attached to it, one of which is to help support wraparound services for apprentices. So it actually pays for things like childcare, transportation, things like that, to make sure that we can get apprentices into really, really needed sectors. And obviously, we're really interested in that based on the conversation that we just had about workforce and things here. So really excited to see that go forward with some money attached. And then also 5736, which is around partial hospitalization and IOP treatment for minors. So this was something that was really important. WISHA strongly supported it, so did we, and it just helps get this benefit out to more kiddos who have behavioral health services. And so expanding that, it followed on a successful pilot that happened at two children's hospitals, so it's just going to expand that access for youth as we look at the behavioral health needs, especially for our youth rising. This is a really important bill. Some of the bills that didn't pass this session: 1868, which was the big one that we spent a lot of time working on. So it did end up dying in Ways and Means. It didn't pass out of Ways and Means in time to be heard by the entire Senate. And that was the nurse ratios, nurse staffing bill. And so I think that this is not the last time that we'll see this bill. We'll probably see it next year as well. And so having some conversations about how to make our workplace great for all of our employees, which we do here anyway, but at a broader scale for hospitals across Washington state, is going to be really important work in the next 9 months before the session kicks off again next January. 1741 was affordability through healthcare provider contracting. That did not pass, which was we were good, happy about that. It proposed to restrict hospital contracting. It gave insurance carriers more leverage in contract negotiations, and it came after they saw a bill in California that was similar pass, and so we're glad that that one didn't make it through. One thing that we are disappointed that didn't make it even through the House in the very beginning was addressing consent to long-term care placement and services. And so one of the issues that we have is having patients here in-house who we are not able to move on to a long-term care facility because they do not have guardians that can consent to that care placement. This bill looked at expanding that group of people who can say, yes, this person should be in long-term care if they cannot make that decision for themselves. It didn't pass in the House, but we are going to look at it again next year. And so hopefully that will that will move forward. Case, you're muted.
Case, you're muted.
Mm-hmm. Could you explain why there was resistance to that bill, 2083? What's the logic that people, well, assuming there was logic, sorry, what was the reason that they gave for not wanting to support that?
It didn't even pass out of the House. My sort of insider baseball assumption is that it was a really busy session and there were so many bills that they had to go through that it just didn't even make it to the top. And so I think based on Wish's comments, this is the busiest short session that they've seen. So it just wasn't something that had enough oomph to get it past that first hurdle. That being said, I think it'll probably pop up next year, most likely, because it's a really important bill to make sure that we can take care of patients into the post-acute care settings that they need to get into. Mike, did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, there also was a concern that let's be mindful of any unintended consequences, because I think the Adult Protective Services agencies were somewhat concerned that making a placement into a skilled nursing facility, you know, possibly with, you know, without the per consent of the patient, could be troublesome if there weren't appropriate guardrails in place. I think Wisha agreed and felt that there were appropriate guardrails in place. Mm-hmm. But I think based on Dunya's point that a thousand things going on and week and a half to get this done, they just sort of slow note it to death for this session. And I'm quite certain it will come up next session because our hospitals weren't overwhelmed by COVID patients. They were overwhelmed by patients that they couldn't discharge to long-term care facilities because they're of several reasons, but one reason being going through this process to get consent. So it's a real issue, and I'm quite certain it'll come up next year, and with more time to for thoughtful debate, I think we'll get there.
Are there sufficient beds in those for long-term care placements throughout the state?
Well, it depends on the community. For the most part, it's not the bed. There were staffing issues. I mean, they would go through the same thing we would, where one person would test positive, and you know, depending on the amount of interaction that person had with other staff, that 5 to 6 to 7 people could be knocked out for a week at a time. So I think most of the staffing challenge or the patient placement challenges we faced were more the result of staffed beds and not available beds. But that's a great question, Mari.
Well, just because of us boomers, we're a big group.
Okay.
How about 1616? You said that there were some, is it the smaller hospitals? Is it the size or is it that it's a public hospital district? And what were the differences that they put in terms of charity care requirement?
So it was the size. So tier one hospitals are ones that are owned or operated by a health system that owns or operates 3 or more acute hospitals, including Children's, Overlake, Evergreen, Kirkland, and Legacy Salmon Creek. So they are the big hospital systems. They have free up to 300% of the federal poverty level, 75 discount between 301 to 350, and a 50% discount from 351 to 400. Tier two is just all hospitals who don't fall into tier one. And so they're the rural hospitals, the small hospitals, sole community hospitals, just the smaller systems. They have free care up to 200% federal poverty levels compared to the 300% in tier one, 75% discount from 201 to 250 and 50% from 251 to 300. So those are the big differences between those two buckets. It'll start July 1st of 2022.
Thank you.
Okay.
Next slide, please. And then there was a ton of exciting things that went into the budget. This was a really great year for budgets. So the big four buckets that we were watching closely, first of all, was healthcare, workforce, education, and pipeline. There was a lot of money that went into this bucket. They're supporting an additional 180 nursing slots at both the UW and community colleges across the state. That was $5 million. They are supporting a new BSN program at Eastern Washington University with $6.2 million and simulation labs as well for $15.2 million. So really trying to address this workforce issue, especially with RNs. They also put in a bunch of money into the difficult to discharge and long length of stay bucket through investing in long-term care systems. And so really trying to figure out how do we support these systems and bolster them to get that flow going, which is what I think we spent a lot of time this session talking about internally, which is us in a silo work pretty well, but as soon as we need to send patients places, like that system needs to be working for us to be truly successful. There were significant investments in behavioral health as well. I think one of the exciting capital projects is that Jamestown Sklallam Healing Center got an additional, I think, $3.5 million to support their campus and the extension into a few psychiatric beds and ENT. So that's really exciting. Mike was integral in helping advocate for that with Representative Theringer. And so I'm really excited for our region because that's a critical resource that we need out here on the peninsula. And then also the Washington Medical Coordinating Center was fully funded through the remainder of this biennium. And so they're really looking at how do we look at resources across Washington State in the event of a surge or another pandemic, which we won't even talk about, but really what does our state look like and how do we navigate those resources across? So it was a really great year for our budget priorities.
Yeah, there's probably another $25 million of state allocated funding that's sort of sloshing around the margins with respect to workforce expansion. We played an active role in understanding the laws that were going through Olympia and talking with our delegation about the ones that could help us. We got actually that $5 million, the community college gets the lion's share of it. I think 1.2 goes to UW and 3.8 goes to community colleges. But we're convinced that we're not going to fix the staffing crisis by taking out more ads, buying more space in the newspaper, or putting up clever signs on the ferry, that we need to strike innovative arrangements with community colleges, with trade and tech schools, with four-year universities, reach out to partners that we haven't reached out before, and begin to work with them in a meaningful way. That I think it's going to be a challenge the next couple of years staff to meet our needs just because of the place that the workforce is in right now. But 2, 3, 4 years down the road, when this program work begins to take shape and pay off, I think we'll be in a much better place for the long run. It's a big focus of ours.
Next slide, please. And then briefly, some of our federal advocacy work. As soon as the session ended, they opened up the congressionally directed funding or the earmarks for the federal ask for 2023. And so I think Mike and I had like 7 minutes to breathe before we jumped into doing some earmark work here. Our asks to all three, Representative Kilmer and Senators Cantwell and Murray, is going to focus on a linear accelerator for oncology. And so those, it was very short turnaround times, 2 weeks for Representative Kilmer and 3 weeks for the other, our two senators. We're also looking for money to support green technology for the new building, based on some conversations that Mike had that I think he'll share. It's the wave of the future, and we need to get in front of it and find funding to help support that to make sure that our building is up to date, up to code, and is really looking to the future.
Well, yeah, as we talked during the generative governance meeting, that the state is rapidly pushing organizations from relying on hospitals doing the right thing because it's the right thing to kind of nudging them and requiring them to do the right thing. For instance, we learned that new building permits, particularly around parking lots, will likely require 20% of all parking lots have a electronic vehicle charging station. There is discussion, and it's subject to interpretation, about hospitals being required to have a power cogeneration plant and to have the ability to create its own power through solar panels or windmills or some other form. We are just beginning to understand this through our engineering team, or our design and contractor team, but it's happening. And we've been focused like a laser beam on finding dollars for the linear accelerator over the last several months. We probably started 6 months ago, because it's probably going to be a $6 to $10 million all-in spend, and it's an incredibly important technology for our community. We think it's a technology that lots of federal funding sources want to help communities like ours deliver. So that's a big part of this work, but also infrastructure to help us pivot to the green economy or to green energy, reduce our carbon footprint, and also prepare for what other crisis might be down the road. We just gone through 2 years of a pandemic, but that doesn't mean we get a 2 year pass on when the next earthquake will occur. A lot of focus on bringing in federal and state dollars to help us with these important projects.
As we get further down the design build process, I'm working really closely with Jake to better understand some of the priorities for funding that we can get through an advocacy lens. So if stormwater is one of those, we can go find funding for that. So I think it'll become clear as we get further down sort of the process itself of what it's going to look like and where we need to find funds for. Overall, I think that this was a really successful state session. There was a lot of learning, I think, on all parts. And I'm excited for what the next session has. I think we have a good strategy moving forward, and engaging our legislators early is going to be a key part of that, as well as our community, and making sure that they know that we're on their side. We're members of this community. And so I'm excited for that work too.
And just sort of in the cycle with, we're talking about fundraising for a linear accelerator that might go in the new building that, might be built next year and might be completed in 2 or 3 years. And when we start talking about these things, they seem so far off. It seemed like we talked about a dental clinic for years before we filled the first cavity. But kind of an exciting end of the cycle point is I got an email from Brent at Jamestown Clinic today, and he wants to meet with our primary care team to begin talking about establishing protocols for how their healing clinic, Suboxone Center, can complement the work that we are doing. So if it sounds like we talk about these things forever, it's kind of because we do. But they have such long lead times, and particularly when you're trying to build them using someone else's money, it does take a while, but it happens. And I think that, when the healing center is opened, there will be some patients from Port Townsend that will benefit greatly from the different type of Suboxone treatment that is provided at that clinic than we provide in our clinics. So it's all good. It's worth the wait. Any other questions for Dunya?
Okay. Yeah, Dunya, are you going to Washington, D.C.?
I am still in conversations with my partner on that one.
Okay. Second question. Is there a list of advocacy priorities from the state association for the DC trip? And if so, could that be spread around to the commissioners who are not going?
Yeah, short answer is no. There's not right now. This is sort of off cycle in terms of their advocacy work. They usually deliver something towards the end of the year. They're just now meeting with public policy and building it up. So we'll probably use the same document that was created fourth quarter of last year and maybe some shifting focuses. But I can certainly find out what that is. We plan to be far more Jefferson healthcare focused than go in with five or six. Here's what's good for the Washington State Hospital Association delegation. Been in active discussions with all of these projects. We're in discussions with getting money for a child care center. Discussions about possibly a wellness center. All these sort of things that we want to continue to push on, but also help our delegation understand how they are being prioritized from our viewpoint.
Well, I think having a toddler along should help us get some childcare monies, don't you think, Dunya?
As long as they're on the flight with me and they hear her shrieking for five straight hours, yeah, they'll be like, get that kid some childcare because this is a long trip.
I can't imagine better advocates than Mike and Dunya. They are an unbeatable team. They are so articulate and knowledgeable and impressive.
Thank you. It was super helpful to have everyone do their part as well. And I think Tina Toner was phenomenal this year as well, helping us build that nurse case, which is great. And Jill and Mari, I really appreciated your work as well. And then Case, you too. Like it was a team effort for sure this year. And I think it'll look similar next year as well. So it was a lot of fun.
Yep. It's just something you got to be good at as an organization, unfortunately, you have to pay attention to what's going on and be able to stop the bad things from happening. Okay, thanks, Dunya. Next slide, please. So in my administrative update, I'm going to talk a little bit about the design team general contractor for the campus expansion planning process and connect the resources that we expect to expend with the budgeted dollars. Brief update on our organizational improvement work as that's beginning to take shape. I mentioned that DNV is in the virtual house with their annual three-day survey, and then share some AHA WISHA common themes. So I'll probably just go down the bottom three now and then spend a little bit more time talking about the first one. We've been moving slowly but surely on getting our arms around our organizational improvement work. We are convinced that your organization is as effective as your workforce culture drives it to be. We've talked a lot about challenges coming up in the next few years as we pivot from managing COVID to the world we used to know about healthcare, and work that we are doing to improve the work environment. And this is just such a perfect intersection because it's focused on improving both. So we've identified a leadership team that's meeting on a weekly basis. And beginning to put together all of the different parts and pieces of this engagement, and there are a lot of them. We issued a leadership it's like an organizational readiness assessment, a survey which indicates the different areas of the work and characteristics that are often related to high performing organizations that will guide us as to where to start and how far and how deep to go with respect to the results from that survey. We have identified a date for our first Leadership Development Institute, which is June 21st. So about 50 some odd leaders will spend all day, kind of the official launch of this work. We spent, the leadership team spent all day Monday working on what that retreat would look like and putting together the different components of it. And we are beginning to do some shared learning exercises. You know, we've mentioned going through the Huron Culture of High Performance book. While the book is you know, powerful and intuitive and reminds you of the things that these are the behaviors that lead to best care and a best workplace. But more important than that, it's a shared experience. So once a month, we break out into groups and we talk about the book and relate it to what's going on in our departments and what's going on with our work. And that's where the magic is. Those are discussions that high performing organizations have. And frankly, I think we have been challenged by not having enough of those discussions where there can be honest, frank feedback, people getting vulnerable about work in their areas and challenges and frustrations. So it's the shared experience of reading 30 pages, 40 pages a month, and then sharing it with your cohorts. So it's all laying this foundation that needs to occur, I think, before the progress begins. And thus far, it's going very well. I couldn't help but mention that a couple of common themes with American Hospital Association and the Washington State Hospital Association, I sort of find myself in this spot where I'm kind of in these leadership positions in both organizations. And, you know, now that meetings are sort of kicking back up again, I went to an AHA meeting at the beginning of the month. And a wish meeting on Friday. And the issues that everybody is talking about are workforce, and not only the expansion and the development. So the number of able-bodied employees that can show up to work every day, but it's just the spirit of the workforce. And many of the things that we are working on and are challenged with, other organizations are too. And I have maintained for quite a while that that if, you know, as a hospital CEO, if you don't think you have some, if there hasn't been a cultural shift in your place, and probably not for the better, you either aren't looking, or you have your head in the ground, or you're clueless, because you can't go through what healthcare organizations have gone through the last 2 years and not have some shift. And we've talked about it as a group for the first 3 to 6 months. It was exciting and it was invigorating wow, we're really stepping up and doing this important work and doing amazing things and standing up COVID clinics over the weekend and standing up a testing center in 3 or 4 days and then putting 29,000 needles in our community's arms. This really feels good. Well, fast forward 20 months, and not only are all the challenges of that beginning to take a toll, but the any fissures or issues your workplace or your culture may have had before the big distraction are either reappearing or they are, and in many cases in a greater way than maybe when you first identified them. It's been fascinating because we've been doing this work for about a year, recognizing the opportunities that we have with respect to our workplace. And, frankly, it has had as much urgency as any other thing we have been working on. And now I'm just now seeing other organizations identify kind of the same challenges. And I think it's going to be pretty important for everybody, the entire industry, to recognize, address in a meaningful way, and then move forward. And it's hard to do when everybody is tired in need of somehow filling up their own tanks. But what's fascinating is that Washington State Hospital Association, that's theme number one. The American Hospital Association, that's theme number one. And I suspect it's something every hospital in the country is grappling with. So I'm pleased that we are taking that work head on. In addition to workforce cybersecurity, there was grave concern about cyber stalking prior to what's going on in Ukraine. But certainly the last month, there's even greater concern for the most vulnerable and high profile institutions. And I think hospitals fall into that category of being targeted by bad actors. And it can be just so paralyzing to any organization, but particularly a hospital. And also this looming shift from, we think that the healthcare futurists are saying the shift from the payment world you know now to the new risk managed care based programs is probably going to come at you faster than you are comfortable with, and some of that just stems from the amount of resources that have been thrown at healthcare the last couple of years. It's naive to think that there's not going to be some payback to that. And we are already beginning to see it in what Medicare and Medicaid are beginning to signal with respect to future increases and how they are going to manage complicated reimbursement issues. So the good news is that, COVID isn't, completely pinning us. The not so good news is all the challenges of running a small rural hospital before COVID didn't go away. We have lots of important work to do to remain strong and viable and continue to meet the needs of our community. So that's probably a good segue into the last topic. And Brittany, if you could go to the next slide, that would be super. So I wanted to give you an update on where we are at with our design contractor team. As you know, we went through this long, very regulated process to select a progressive design bid team to help us with the project. The project we used for the base of that was the basically 10-year master site plan. So all of the needs that we felt our community could benefit from over the next decade were sort of included in that initial project document. And We were going to go through this process and select the construction team and the architect that we felt could best take us through a more precise planning process and identify the highest priority facility and existing service and new service needs. So we chose Abbott Construction and ZGF architectural firms. Abbott's a Seattle-based, very deep healthcare design and construction experience organization. ZGF has a handful of offices on the West Coast. I think their corporate office is Portland, but they have a significant Seattle footprint and have been involved in a lot of healthcare design projects, which is nice because the building that is most likely going to have to be replaced is right in the middle of the ESSB and the 95 inpatient tower. So how the design team and the contractors are going to have to be very sensitive to, we're basically running two hospitals on the outskirts of a construction project that's going on right in the middle. The project launched March 9th, where we had a Dirksen room full of designers and Jefferson Healthcare representatives and sort of walked through how we are going to work together and sort of what a high level timeline would look like. Since then, there yesterday and tomorrow, there was and there will be kind of initial end user design meetings where the end users meet directly with the design teams and share their thoughts and before a workshop, which is when everyone gets together and they sort of view it from the context of the entire project. Starting off with service specific input. Then we have these workshops where everybody sits around from the guy, the designer in charge of the roof to the air handler units, to the electrical systems, to the exam rooms. And everybody is in the same room talking about how all these important parts and pieces can come together. And we think that will be scheduled for April 5th. We hope at that meeting to begin to identify the, I think there's three or four targeted community meetings where we will go out to the community and say, hey, here's what the data told us with respect to services that we need. Here's the services that are people leaving the community for. Here's how we think we might could meet them. You know, what say you? So that those will be interesting and I think helpful meetings, and we'll go through the spring and probably into the summer. And again, we'll try to start them in April. And I should also say that we are getting closer to what the work timeline will look like. And I plan to have that presented during my administrative update at the April board meeting. So you'll be able to see kind of a much more in-depth view of how this work is staging and will roll out. So in terms of the budget, we budgeted $3 million for all of the design and design from the design team and also from the general contractor as they get us from, you know, blank piece of paper to a place where we can identify a an estimated cost of the project. So that means we have to define it. This is what we're going to build. This is what we think it will cost. And we expect that to occur in probably the end of third quarter of the year, or actually before that. So We target $3 million for this. The 1.56 is the number that was proposed, and that work has begun and will begin in earnest here real soon. Next slide. Mike. So the high level goals of the project, I'm almost through, Case. How about if I get through these and then, sure, and take your question? That there's really three big high level goals of the project that we've been speaking about for quite some time. First, replace and or retrofit our vulnerable buildings. We've done two engineering reports that have identified basically the unit I'm in and the unit that Tyler and HR and several other folks are in extremely vulnerable to seismic activity. Also including the cafeteria. So that is a high priority of this project. Second, relocate and expand mission critical infrastructure and services that are in those spaces. So a great example of that is cafeteria. Dietary and cafeteria are in the space that we feel is highly vulnerable to seismic activity. And that would be a real bad thing if that was taken out of service. But also, so is our MRI, so is our Express Clinic and our Women's Health Clinic. So those services we believe are important to continue to provide to the community need to be relocated. And then improve, modernize, and expand clinical space to meet the needs of our community. Anybody who's been up through the ESSB will know that there is no room at the end, and that arguably on most days we do not have enough clinical exam space to run our oncology and our wound clinic at the same time. Not to mention the fact that both of those services just kind of continue to organically grow. And in addition to that, there are other clinical needs and clinical services that our community continues to seek outside of Port Townsend, and we will be looking to see if there's a way to better deliver those to our community. And lastly, the primary care space that our primary care providers are in is not as modern as the structure of their practice would require. It's a very progressive approach to practicing primary care in a space that wasn't designed for that type of a practice. So part of this also is going to be, is there a primary care solution that will better meet the needs of our caregivers and our teams? And then lastly, the last goal of the project is figure out a way to identify what the financial needs of the project will be, which won't be until we determine what we're going to build and then how we're going to pay for it. And basically four big buckets, Jefferson Healthcare cash reserves, debt. You know, we financed the ESSB through a business plan that demonstrated it would generate this amount of revenue, and that would allow us to pay for the mortgage payment, if you will. We anticipate doing the same thing for this building. Federal and state funding, I mean, truly that could be $5 to $20 million for some of the big ticket items that we would like to include in this project. So that's a big part of it. And if necessary, depending on what the project ends up being when we get through this process, direct community support by way of a bond. So happy to entertain questions now.
I had a question about the previous slide where I was a little confused with the total that was listed and where the $3 million came from then. Is this what we had budgeted and this is what we actually need? Or I guess I'm a little confused.
Yeah, one of the reasons I'm showing this to you is that for budgeted items over $100,000, I am supposed to present to the board when those we begin spending those items. This is included in the 2022 capital budget, I believe, and it's $3 million. It was a placeholder, and again with this new design, you are beginning to pay architects and contractors when you start the process. Mm-hmm. So it's pay them now, and less later. So in our first estimate with how much this would be for the duration of 2022 was $3 million, and the proposal that we reviewed from Abbott and ZGF that takes us all the way through say November, we think is going to be about $1.5 million. Mm-hmm. So if we move forward, there's no question we will spend all that three and more.
Sure.
But this is the $3 million was the placeholder for getting us to November, the number as it actually came in was 1.5.
And what is GMP? What is GMP?
Guaranteed project price. And you're probably thinking.
So there's
guaranteed maximum price.
Guaranteed maximum price. Thank you, Tyler. The benefit of the progressive design bid is when we get through spending 1.56 on this process, Abbott and ZGF will say, "I will build that for you for $50 million," and that's the guaranteed maximum price.
Got
so
it.
There aren't change orders. There aren't, you wanted a faucet to go with that sink. You avoid all of that. And so the guaranteed maximum price, it's a pretty important part of the milestone. Because the contractor and the architect is shaking hands with the owner saying we can build that for you for this amount.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Hey, Mike.
Yeah.
I have a question. So the 1.56, is that really what we think it'll be for the year, or is there going to be some additional in the fourth quarter there that we don't know yet?
Probably. Okay. Probably. We have such of a little run rate to evaluate this by, we'll give you updates on what we're actually spending during each of these quarters, versus the 1.5 and the three. But it's possible that, that fourth quarter there will be some continued spending if we have clear line of sight on what we're going to build, how we're going to pay for it, we probably will just keep chugging along. It's possible around November we will be waiting to see how much financial support we have for the project, and in that case there would likely be a delay. But that's a great question, Bruce. More than likely, there will be some spending in the fourth quarter, and the next time that Jake and I are with the team, we'll see if we can get an estimate of that.
Okay, thanks.
So is there any projected or hoped for date in the fourth quarter? That's a pretty big span, particularly if we're looking at a potential bond.
No, we're racing to get the project expands to a point where it is going to require community support, we will, you know, we, the board will make that decision in the summer. So
basically in the third quarter, the board will need to make a decision.
Yeah.
Okay. And if none of us complain today, then I assume this gives you the green light to spend 1.56?
Well, yeah. I mean, you could always shut that down, but we went through the process of in the budget we talked through this and uh-huh. and that would be the better time to shut it down. but of course, if you were uncomfortable with this, yes. But I think because there are so many zeros after those crooked numbers, it's going to be important that we. Keep you abreast on how yep. this is going the article that came was in the newspaper several months ago presented this like we had this very precise completely completed vision of what we were going to build and it could not have been farther from the truth that work begins now and it truly it. You know, we speak of this and there could be two or three or four different projects that come out of this based on several different factors that we're going to begin doing that work on. And so I hope that every month as this project goes on, I will be more, articulate about and coherent about describing it. But really, it's just we're just starting now and the project could look. Takes several different shapes and it's kind of exciting actually.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was a very thorough and report all the way around, Mike.
Good. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mike about any of that? A lot of information there.
Okay. Thank you, and unfortunately we're without Dr. Mattern tonight, so you won't have that awesome CMO report. My apologies.
But we'll miss that. That's for sure. It's always informative as well, and he's always so energetic. Yeah. It's a nice way to end.
Agree.
Okay, then we'll move on to our board business. And the first item is the Board of Health and Commissioner Kauf, you sent us the report. Is there anything you'd like to add to that or mention at this meeting?
Well, since Joe Mattern isn't here to tell you what the latest COVID case rate is, I'm very happy to announce that we are now down to 62 cases per 100,000 from the last 2 weeks. Which puts us in a very, Jefferson Public Health website, if you go on there, it has a wonderful, sort of like the fire danger report, and it has a very good indication of where we are. And between 50 and 100 is an excellent place to be at 62. And now the rate is being calculated twice a week and being posted twice a week because things have come down so rapidly. And of course, we'd like to see it down to under 50. That would make a huge difference. But Dr. Barry is feeling more and more comfortable with the relaxation that she is recommending for people who are vaccinated and indoors. So life can approach a little bit more normal. The only other thing, yes, Mari.
Yeah, Case, I was wondering if you have any inclination as to how many people self-test and don't report. Is there any data?
I don't know if there's any data, but what Dr. Barry has been suggesting is that you just multiply it by 4. Mm. And that tells you probably close to what's actually happening.
So you mean multiply 62 by 4?
That's right. And that'll give you the probable indication of what's really happening. For a variety of reasons, not only do many people not know and not even self-test, but then, as you suggest, there are people who self-test and don't report. The other thing is, we spent quite a bit of time at the Board of Health meeting talking about the new bylaws, because as I have reported several times in the past months, the composition of the Board of Health is changing. It's going to go to an 8-person board, only 4 of whom can be elected. That is the 3 county commissioners and 1 city council person. The representative that we have been sending from Jefferson Healthcare is not considered a, quote, municipally elected member of the board. And so the person who we suggest be appointed by the county commissioners and approved by the county commissioners would be somebody who fits a category. And there's a description: you've got to be in healthcare, you have to have experience in public health, et cetera, et cetera. There are a number of possible descriptions, and fortunately, I meet a couple of those, and so I will not have to leave the board this summer. But there are actually 2 people currently on the board, Dennis Stern and Sheila Westerman, who will have to step off the board. And we're still waiting to hear about required representation from 1 or more local tribes. And so that'll be a good addition. And we struggled quite a bit with, well, what do we do if there's a tie vote, if there are 8 people on the board? And we simply we're simply avoiding the question, which is, if there's a tie, then whatever motion has been put forth to be voted on basically dies and does not go forward. So that's the easiest way to deal with a tie, and that's what we'll probably end up doing. And other than that, there was some good information about COVID, and just a reminder that the Omicron variant is not less serious for people than the original coronavirus. It's just as serious to cause hospitalizations and death as was the original coronavirus. The only difference is that a lot of people are now immunized, and therefore we think that it is less severe, but it isn't. So it's just one more important plea for people to get their booster. And hopefully fairly soon there'll be approval for an additional booster, particularly for people who are elderly.
Mike,
I won't mention any names. Like myself.
Mike, you have your hand up?
Yeah, just to let you know that when this discussion concludes and there's a good opportunity, Brandy is on the line and she can give the board kind of a end of day one DNV report, if you would be interested in that.
But definitely, yes.
Whenever the board thinks is appropriate.
Thank you. Okay.
Good. Okay. I'm done with my report. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Any news? I read in the paper this morning that the new variant, the newest variant, B2, is been on the peninsula now. Is on the peninsula?
Yes, that's correct. There's always a delay in finding out when it's here, because it takes a while to do the genetic testing on it. But it definitely is here. Probably, like in most situations, it's cropped up first, I think, on the East Coast more significantly. But it will definitely, it is more contagious than the B1 Omicron variant, the first one that came around.
Thank you. All right. thank you for the report, Case, and thank you for your written report as well. It's informative. We have an agenda evaluation. How did you all like the agenda today and the last couple of meetings that we've had? I think we do this quarterly. Is there anything that we seem to be missing? Or Mari, I saw your hand go up.
Yeah, I think it has continued to cover what the board members seem to want and provide us with the opportunity for information and particularly, which was, I think, Matt's suggestion many moons ago, that we've got the opportunity for regular meetings to add something if we think it's necessary. So I'm reasonably happy with how things have gone along with the agenda.
Okay. Anybody else? Bruce, what about you?
I'm happy with it too. I don't think we're missing anything.
Matt?
Yeah, no complaints here.
Okay. Case?
Well, there's just always so much information. I am glad that we now have these special generative sessions, because that does satisfy mostly my desire for us to have more discussion.
Great. Okay. Mike, is there anything that you want to say that you'd like to see us have, or any way we can be of more benefit to you?
No.
In our meetings? Okay.
These are just fine.
Could I ask one question about the next meeting, Jill?
Yes.
So, Mike, you said that we would be getting a fuller report about the timeline and activities, but our meeting isn't until the end of April, and in the slide you said something about community engagement or activities would start in April. So I guess I'm sort of wondering if the board isn't going to be a little bit sort of behind the eight ball on all of that, or whether there needs to be some additional communication to us before the community outreach actually starts.
Well, we certainly can do that. I think the reason that those dollars for the next couple of months are so high is that we're kind of being shot out of this like a cannon. Mm-hmm. And things are going to move really fast, and in order, you know, usually it's like lots of stakeholder involvement, move the project along fast, pick one. Mm-hmm. So I think that we're gonna try to cover all of that ground, and it'll probably be at the expense of not briefing the board each month on what we're gonna do the next month. But when we do target those community meetings, and if one does fall before the next board meeting, we'll certainly let you know what we're thinking and what the purpose is. And I mean, they really are just, hey, you know, a broad brushed input on what's going well, how can we do better, and you got to start. But fair question, Case, and we will I will be sensitive to that.
Thank you.
Case, the other thing to remember is our meeting was changed to the 20th. It's not the 27th, the next month.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. And speaking of the next meeting, I'm going to be gone. And so Mari will probably be chairing. We're not sure at this point whether we'll have in-person meeting or whether it will remain this way, Microsoft Teams. So we'll make that decision a little later down the line, but we're prepared. We'll be prepared either way. Let's Nancy, and I'll be back at the end of May for the May meeting. So is there any other discussion, any other board business that anyone would like to bring up? Questions, comments? Okay, then we could have the meeting evaluation now, or we could have it after executive session. Oh, Mari, you have your hand up? You're muted.
Are we not going to have a brief report from Brandy regarding the first day?
I was going to see if we were going to do the meeting evaluation first or not, but let's go ahead with Brandy.
Well, I don't have any slides prepared, so this should go really quickly for us.
That's a first.
End of day one, you know, I wish everybody could spend a day seeing our organization through the lens of a surveyor, because it really actually just fills my tank every single time. So we have three surveyors with us for 2.5 days. Today was day one, and they'll wrap up Friday by about noon. Today we opened up with just sort of leadership and kicking off the day. We rolled into a session with all three of our surveyors, looking at our COVID practices, at infection control in general, and then really focusing on the COVID vaccination requirement. So that's one of the things CMS is having surveyors take a look at when they come. From then, they broke out into quality management, emergency services, so emergency room, safety and utility management. And then in the afternoon, we did medication management, purchasing, critical care, respiratory therapy, medical equipment, and emergency management. And I'm happy to report that we had zero nonconformities found today. So after a very long, now we still have a day and a half, but we have a whole page of noteworthies. So I want to just call out a couple of those things. And you hear me say it month after month, but it's really cool when the surveyors say it too. So they started off by really just being appreciative and recognizing all of the infection control efforts and practices, not necessarily from one person or another person, but really from an entire systems-based perspective, from every bedside staff member who took a minute to participate in the PPE Council, to our employee health team, of course, to Laura, to leadership, to our COVID physicians, and every other person who's participated. A lot of really noteworthy efforts there. They really were complimentary of in general the engagement across the organization. They called out our strong provider leadership. They said in every session they were at, in everything that they looked at, it was very clear that we have strong provider leadership and engagement, which they loved to see. And specifically, and I see him still on the call here, they really called out our DART team. And, you know, like I said, I do this every single month because they blow me away. But they all three had so many nice things to say about our data and analytics team, and they compared our quality management system and our data and analytics to that of an extremely large healthcare system. So very cool to see. They said they have not seen this level of work in a critical access hospital. They just have not. So really cool work, and thank you, Sean. They talked about another noteworthy effort was the engagement of our staff and leaders in quality and safety. Also recognizing some of the work that we're doing to tighten that up and make it even better. They talked about good processes improvement in the new IV pump project in medication management. Let's see here. We had a couple of just opportunities to improve some documentation that will not be a nonconformity, just opportunities for improvement. So we'll take those to heart and work on those. And this is one that I'm really sad that Tina Toner is not on the line. We have a leader who recently tendered his resignation and made us all really kind of very sad. Jeff Hestand is an incredible leader. I think any of us who've had the privilege to get to work with him know that. And as an organization, we know that and we're very aware of that. But I don't know that the whole world knows that. Well, now at least three surveyors across the country know it, because they got to spend some time looking at respiratory therapy
And I wrote it down in quotes because it was so cool. Our clinical surveyor, who's a nurse by background, said she could go on and on about respiratory therapy. And she went on to say, I have done a lot of surveys and I have been doing this for a very long time. And this is the strongest program I have ever seen. So just take that in for a minute and think about that. That is amazing. She has a 40-year career in healthcare. And Jeff Hiestand and his team is the strongest she's ever seen. So it makes me get choked up just because he's amazing. And I think what an incredible way to kind of go out. So if you see him, yeah, definitely give him a pat on the back, of a high five, whatever it is. So they went on to name like 10 different things that are happening there, and all well deserved. They went on to give a noteworthy comment to our Energy Star program, which you guys talked about last month, which was great. And they also gave a noteworthy comment to our nurse cross training and residency program. So really recognizing the impact that COVID has had on our clinicians across the country and staffing and how challenging that's been. They were so complimentary of Tina and HR and the work that they've been doing to just try to get in front of it in any way that they can. So that was pretty awesome. And then lastly, they gave kudos to the emergency management team. And while I wish that I could take any smidge of credit for that, I cannot, because that is an awesome team as well. And specifically, the thing that they were blown away by was Rachel Barbietto, who is working with that team to create an app for us to be able to communicate during disasters electronically. So just continuing to really move the dial on innovation and teamwork and communication, and it shined through today. So great job. Thanks to Kelly, Jake, Laura Showers, Tina and Jen Peach, and Chris O'Higgins all were instrumental in the survey today. So tomorrow we will be looking at medical staff, human resources. We'll be looking at dietary, our patient advocates and grievance process. We'll go to the OR. They will be going to surgical associates. They will go to ACU. They'll look at safety management and security, hazardous waste, and they'll do a life safety tour. So more to come, but it was a great first day.
Great. Congratulations. Yay.
Thanks to our teams. They're incredible.
Everybody, thank you from the board.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for letting me share. I appreciate the time.
That was a great way to end the meeting, almost. I mean, almost end, not almost great. Okay, so let's go ahead and do the meeting evaluation. Then we will go into executive session. And when we come out, we probably will take action, but then we can just conclude. So how did you think the meeting went? Case, you're on top there, center. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the meeting was great. We certainly have a lot going on, and and I think all of the staff went through very efficiently and with stuff that I think is very important for us to keep on top of. So I think it went well.
Okay. Matt?
Yeah, great meeting, informative. Excellent.
Yeah, it was a great meeting. I always appreciate the educational part, so it was really good.
Maury?
Yes, likewise. And I just want to congratulate all those employees, the employee of the quarter, the provider of the quarter, the leadership and the team of the quarter, because of all their hard work and how that helps us take care of our community.
Okay, yeah. Good meeting. All of the above. And I thought it was an excellent meeting, too. All right, so Mike, do you have any thoughts about the meeting?
Oh, very good. Thanks.
Okay. All right, then at this point, we will go into an executive session, and we will be discussing the performance of a public employee. And would you like to take a 5-minute break, or do you want to just go straight through? I figured 20 minutes. What did you say, Maury?
I think a 5-minute break would be good. I don't know, but I'm easy either way.
Okay.
I've just got to find my way back to where I've got to go.
All right. So it is 5:20. We will take a 5-minute break and.
So we go to a different link. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yes. Go to a different link and then we come back.
So we can struggle together.
Speech. Hold on. So we are going into executive session. We may be taking action. We will take a 5-minute break and plus 20 minutes for the meeting, which gives us, my math is terrible. So 5:15, let's say 5:45, we'll reconvene here on this link. So commissioners, go to the next link and we will be back on this link at 5:45.
And remind me, do we have to sign out of this one or can we leave it open?
You can leave it open.
Thank you.
And I just sent you the link in your email to make that a little bit easier on all of you.
Okay. And Mike, what do you have?
Yeah, I am going to step away. But the question is, Brittany, this is one of those rare nights where Brittany's not juggling two or three kid activities. So she can stay and help you with the executive session if you like. That option is available to you.
How would we go on to how would we do our logistically do manage the Teams meeting?
Sounds like that's a vote for having Brittany join you.
I think that's right.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
We can make it. Well, I don't know how many we can make it.
No, that's fine. I don't want to speak for you, Brittany, but it's my understanding that this works for you. You can do this.
I've got it fully covered.
Okay. Very good. Okay.
Great. We'll be as concise as possible.
You're good to go.
Okay. Thank you, Mike.
I'll see you guys in the other link.
Thanks, Mike. Okay. Well, over and out, and we'll go back. Couple minutes, we'll reconnect.
Okay.
Recording
started.
Okay, we are back in regular session. We were at 5:45, but we didn't get the recording started. But now we are all here and present in our regular session. And is there a motion from anyone for Mike's compensation? Bruce?
Yeah, I'll make a motion that we bump his base pay to $300,000.
I'll second.
Per year.
Okay. Is there discussion? Right. Yes, Bruce.
Yeah, I mean, I'll discuss it. I mean, I think, you know, we need to be competitive with the other ones that are going around, you know, that could hire him away close by, you know, that, I mean, that's who we're competing with. And I agree, it's a lot of money. He does a lot of things really well. And even with this, it's going to be below the average what it was in 2020. So.
Okay. Any other discussion? Yes. Case.
I would agree with what Bruce said. And this is not the time for us to risk losing someone when we are about to launch a master plan. And he has shown by his leadership in the past few years, in particular, that he is able to help us go through this. And whether it's advocating at the state or federal level for what we need, I don't think there's any question that Mike has benefited our organization tremendously. And I also agree with Bruce that it's a lot of money, but fortunately and unfortunately, we do need to be competitive in the healthcare market.
Yeah, I would agree totally, because when you compare even just the base rate with Mason General, which isn't that far away, and look at the compensation down there, and you know, even others just across the water in Whidbey, it's essential that we not only show Mike and the community, I think, that he really he has been exceptional in the 10 years, 11 years he's been here, and he's never really received he's received the compensation to a degree, because it's a lot of money, as Bruce and Kay say, but it's I mean this is, I think, to not do this would be wrong.
Okay,
because I mean, look at what we've come through, and look at his leadership, look what we've done, and having been here for 40 years, I can tell you it's just an unbelievable miracle what's happened to Jefferson Healthcare.
Okay. Anyone else? Matt, do you have a comment?
Yeah, I disagree with it. I think it's excessive. And as I've stated, I have some concerns about performance.
Okay. Well, I agree with my other three colleagues, and I think this still, he's in the lower half of compensation from Island Hospital, Samaritan, Mason General, Olympic Medical Center, and Whidbey Health. And he's a stellar performer, stellar CEO, and there is that, and to be fair, he does not expect that, but I believe he deserves it. And if there's no further discussion, I'll call for the vote. All in favor, raise your hand. Okay, that's Bruce, Case, Mari, and Jill. And opposed, Matt. So motion passes. Thank you. And I'll now entertain a motion to conclude the meeting.
So move.
Second.
Discussion? Anything anybody wants to say for the good of the order?
During that executive session, there was complaints lodged towards me. I just want everyone to know, according to law, if you want to make a complaint about a commissioner, you have to give them the option of hearing the complaint in public or in executive session. This is the second time that executive session has been used to lodge complaints against me, and just do them in public if you want to do them, please.
Well, I don't think I mentioned names. So you're the one that mentioned names. At any rate,
I don't think that gets you around it.
All right. If there's no further discussion, all in favor of concluding the meeting, raise your hand.
Aye. Aye.
Okay. Bye-bye. We'll see you all next month.
Okay. If not sooner.
Yes.